You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. To get more in-depth analysis and commentary from our scholars, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast on iTunes, download on Stitcher, or find on our website at brookings.edu/BCP.
Good morning. I'm Daryl West, Vice President of Governance Studies and Director of the Center for Technology Innovation here at the Brookings Institution. And I would like to welcome you to the 8th Annual A. Alfred Taubman Forum on Public Policy. And this forum was established by Mr. Taubman to promote greater understanding of public policy issues. Each year we choose a particular topic and invite experts to offer their views on the subject. Mr. Taubman was a great friend of Brookings. He passed away a couple of years ago, but we continue the forum in order to honor his memory. So this year our topic is the first 100 days of the Trump administration. And we have brought together a number of distinguished experts to discuss his administration's policies and operations on national security, tax reform and regulation, and public management. We are webcasting this event live, so a warm welcome to our viewers from around the country. And we will be archiving the video, so anybody who wishes to watch it after today will have an opportunity to do so through our brookings.edu website. We also have set up a Twitter feed at #100days. That's #100days. So if you wish to post any comments, feel free to do so. So since his inauguration on January 20th, we've seen a number of actions from the administration. This includes the withdrawal from the Trans-Pacific Partnership and the controversial travel ban announced through an executive order. Other policy initiatives such as healthcare repeal and reform have been attempted through congressional legislation, but so far have not been successful. Now, as the 100th day approaches this week, the administration faces new questions on national security and public policy more generally. Our first panel is going to take a close look at those topics, and I will turn the discussion over to our moderator, Shane Harris, a reporter for the Wall Street Journal.
Thanks, Daryl. Good morning, everybody. Thank you for being here as we get ready to celebrate the first 100 days. I think as a national security reporter in Washington covering the Trump administration, the last nearly 100 days have felt maybe like 1,000 days. In my 20 years of covering this beat, I can't remember another time where there has been this much sort of action packed into a short period of time and this many kind of head-spinning events. And I'm primarily just focused on the Russia investigation, so that's not even getting to so many of the other things that have been happening in the past nearly 3 months now. But what we're going to try and do in this panel is to unpack some of that and take stock as best we can of where the administration is and where it's going. And just as a kind of setting the table, one of the things that I think is notable and important to remember in this particular area, at least it's something that's kind of been a guide star for me as I go about reporting on it, is that if you take all of the various policy areas in this vast terrain that we look at in Washington, I can't think of another where the establishment of Washington was more vocally opposed to the then candidate and really sort of positioning and questioning his fitness for office as a central part of the campaign than the Washington establishment in national security and foreign policy. You'll all remember the Never Trump letters that were signed, the degree to which the Republican national security establishment turned against him. And I say that not in terms of setting this in any political cast, but simply to say that I cannot remember a time where so many of the leading thinkers and shapers of ideas and opinion had come out this opposed to a candidate. And so that is something I always keep in mind in terms of how this town, if you like, was really not ready to receive this president and how they have been dealing with that in the first 100 days is something that I'm always keeping in mind to see, to judge how he is doing. So let me just briefly introduce the panel here. I can't really think of many better people, frankly, to have this discussion, so I'm really looking forward to it. Susan Hennessy, to my left, who's a fellow in governance studies here at Brookings and is the managing editor of Lawfare, which you probably are all familiar with, but if you're not reading it, go read it. Leon Wieseltier, who's the Isaiah Berlin Senior Fellow in Culture and Policy and Governance Studies and Foreign Policy here at Brookings and a longtime journalist and commentator in Washington. And my friend Ben Wittes, Senior Fellow in Governance Studies and the co-founder and editor-in-chief of Lawfare. So thank you all for being here. All right, let's have some fun. So Susan, you get the first question. So you were part of that national security and foreign policy establishment. I mean, to some extent, your establishment, and in all the best ways. But you and many of your colleagues, I think, and you have a background in intelligence law, and you worked for the National Security Agency and the General Counsel's Office, openly expressed real concerns and misgivings about what a Trump administration would mean for national security and foreign policy. You wrote a lot about that. You talked a lot about that. So my first question for you is, has Donald Trump exceeded your expectations or fallen short of them?
I mean, expectations for disaster?
Sure,
or
yes.
Expectations for... I'll admit, I had low expectations. I had real reservations, although... wanted to be optimistic, sort of felt from the beginning that as soon as he was elected, our fortunes were tied to his, and we should wish his success and continue to wish his success. That said, I had low expectations, and I can still sort of sit here and say, this is going worse than I had thought it would. Before sort of diving into that, there are some areas that are real bright spots that have gone quite well. The first is sort of the staffing of the national security team. There are really, really excellent people in this administration. General Mattis as Secretary of Defense, H.R. McMaster. There's our colleague Fiona Hill, who's now moved over for the National Security Council. There are lots of people that sort of fall in that bucket of not just being a good national security hire for a Trump administration or sort of on paper, but objectively just a really great, strong national security team. So I think that is a source of comfort and sort of an indication of things being a lot better than maybe people expected them. The flip side of that is, are they being relied on and utilized? Uh-huh. And that's the area in which I think things are going worse. And I do think it sort of is an explanation of some of the whiplash or chaos of the past 100 days. That Trump doesn't appear to be relying on that national security team. He appears to rely quite a bit on sort of family members, informal advisors, even sort of the National Security Council itself. Maybe there's a sort of shadow National Security Council, the Strategic Initiatives uh-huh. Group, and it's not even sort of clear who owns national security policy within the White House itself. And so I think a lot of what we've seen has sort of been national security by instinct instead of expertise. So it's been just remarkably uneven. In attempting to sort of put a strategy on top of what I would argue is absence of any real strategy, people have talked a lot about sort of the unpredictability, and that President Trump has talked a lot about sort of thinking, seeing real strategic value in being unpredictable. I think with sort of the latest tensions around North Korea, we're starting to see some of the real perils of being an unpredictable leader. This is a space in which it's important that we signal not only to our allies but also to our adversaries how we feel, what our intentions are, what our red lines are. Certainly the national security establishment or foreign policy establishment isn't able to understand what exactly the policy is, where we're headed, what our values are. That makes it near impossible to imagine what message is being received all over the world and what the consequences of that might be.
Do you think is he deliberately unpredictable, or is it simply that he's uninformed? And I take as a data point for that an interview that he did with my publication, The Wall Street Journal, where he talked about sitting down with President Xi from China and saying that in the span of 10 minutes he realized that the security dilemma on the Korean Peninsula was a lot harder than he thought. I mean, it seemed like he is willing to acknowledge that he had not come perhaps as prepared as he is now, and of course, what can prepare you for being president? But is it a studied exercise in being unpredictable, or is it simply that he is learning these things as he goes and making decisions based on this new information?
Yeah, so I think it's clear that he is learning things as he goes. That said, no one is elected president with this deep knowledge, deep expertise in everything all the time. There is no person who's like that. That's why you rely on experts and really experienced, knowledgeable counsel. Uh-huh. And so I think that what we're seeing is the ordinary process of a president trying to very rapidly get up to speed on a much more condensed time frame. Uh-huh. We saw that they prepared for the transition much later than other administrations or candidates had in the past. So there's been a steeper learning curve than might have otherwise existed. At the same time, we're seeing sort of a lack of preparation or even an understanding of the need to prepare. So phone calls with foreign leaders that, there aren't briefing books or the staff was caught unaware and sort of the consequences of that. So one, there were a lot of sort of revealing things that occurred during the transition period. So one being the phone call that then President-elect Donald Trump took with the president on Taiwan. So some of his statements during that call and immediately afterwards sort of signaled, hey, maybe this is a real shift in where we are on Taiwan policy. There are some reasonable arguments for that. So, give the brushback pitch and stop sort of being cute about prepositions and how we're going to have the one China policy. So I think there was sort of a desire to say, okay, there's a policy in this. Then the immediate backing off of that position, sort of the quintessential paper tiger here, in response to really strong Chinese opposition. I think it did sort of reveal it of it's a lack of knowledge, right? It's not, there are things that are being done that if it's a conscious decision being made in sort of pursuit of a strategy, there might be good or bad arguments for that. What's happening here is sort of it's more random, and this is an area in which randomness is really quite scary and consequential.
Leon, in the spirit of taking the span of the first 100 days, I want to go back to a column that you wrote 3 days after the election in the Washington Post. I'll just read a brief snippet towards the end of it, in which you were essentially calling for people to stay hot, to stay angry, to stay involved, and not to give in necessarily to the bromides of let's all get along together and Trump saying he wanted to unify.
Yeah, I don't believe in getting along.
And you did not take his plea to do that as genuine in the column, of course. You said, if Trump succeeds, America may fail, and it is America, its values, and its interests whose success matters most desperately to me. No cooling off, then. We must stay hot for America. The political liberty that we cherish in this precious republic is most purely and exhilaratingly experienced as the liberty to oppose. So one question is Trump succeeding, and how hot are you still today?
Look, he's the gift that keeps on giving. I think that right after the election, that the most important challenge for all of us would be to preserve the shock, because the mind wraps itself around things, and the adaptability of the mind in many circumstances is a blessing because it enables us to survive difficult times. But in this case, shock is a sign that one is paying attention. And I've seen nothing in the past 100 days to make me think anything other than that we have a president who is almost incomprehensibly ignorant, with a serious narcissistic personality disorder and a problem of impulse control. Most of the policies that I see coming from Trump are rather like his tweets. They are immediate expressions of something that he feels. Even when he does something that I support, like the Syria strike, which made my week, there was no reason to get too overjoyed about it, because it was perfectly clear that it was not the product of a policy or of a strategy or of any serious moral commitment to humanitarian relief or action. It's random. I remember a couple of years ago, Trump said something egregious. I don't remember what he said, but there are lots of things to choose from. And a reporter from the Times called and asked me if I thought Trump was wrong. And I said, no, I think he's pre-wrong. Meaning that I can't even attribute to him the consistency and stability of an intellectual or ideological framework that would, so I think that we're operating in a different realm here. I mean, Eisenhower liked people to think that he was dumber than he was, and he used English in a way that persuaded them of that. And Nixon, of course, wanted to be known as unpredictable. But those were strategic calculations on the part of more or less rational and certainly well-informed individuals. I think we're dealing with something unprecedented here. I agree that, I mean, I think McMaster and his team are terrific, but one of the things I've learned from the Obama administration, that an entire administration can want to do something, but if the president doesn't want to do it, it will not be done. Moreover, as a consequence of Obama, and by the way, we're not going to discuss this today, it's still heretical to say so, but one of the things we're looking about is the legacy of the Obama presidency, and I think we're going to have to deal with that historically. But in the case of Obama and in the case of George W. Bush, foreign policy had come to be centralized in the White House, I think to an almost unprecedented degree, and certainly in the Obama White House. I mean, every significant issue of foreign policy was dealt with in the White House by the president with his Einstein-like brain and his staff. And we are now, Trump has now taken this to an absolutely absurd place, We have reversed ourselves in the course of 100 days on some of the most frightening and fundamental issues of American foreign policy and national security policy. I mean, these flip-flops are not amusing because they're not about small things. They're really not. And again, in some cases, I think the flop was better than the flip, and you could call it a learning curve. So I actually much prefer the adversarial attitude we have towards Russia and Putin right now. On the other hand, I think it would be an exaggeration to call it a policy, because I simply have no way to know. Putin may actually go on television tomorrow and say that he thinks Trump is a very handsome man, and our policy might change.
That would be extremely well advised.
It would be the right play. It's obvious, right? It's obvious. So I think that, and all of this, the lack of experience, and I say the startling lack of knowledge. I mean, I don't know, frankly, how you get to be a sentient 70-year-old in New York and know this little. I honestly don't understand. It's almost a kind of clinical, it's clinically fascinating in some way. But the startling lack of knowledge combined with the ever-shifting, with the moodiness, the volatility of the thing, combined with the stakes involved in some of these crises. I mean, we are, you know, Obama did not leave the world in good shape. The world was anyway in very bad shape. In many places, crises are happening in fast, slow motion, fast motion. This is not, I mean, it's a perfect storm. I mean, this is not the time for this sort of man to be living in that house. So you put these, I'm enormously concerned.
Ben, after President Trump issued the executive order on immigration and the refugee policy back in January, which was first major action and certainly first major national security action, you wrote a piece in Lawfare sort of trying to gauge to what degree this policy was malevolent or more an example of malevolence tempered by incompetence because it was rolled out in such a ham-handed way, no interagency process. It quickly ran straight into the buzzsaw of the courts. So if you're looking at that kind of tussle, as you've put it, between malevolence and incompetence that seems to have characterized, you know, I think probably more than just the EO, some would argue, which is winning out right now, do you think?
Well, sort of in the bilateral battle between malevolence and incompetence, incompetence is certainly winning. But, you know, that the interesting thing about that phrase, malevolence tempered by incompetence, which is going to be written on my tombstone, I think. I mean, it's something I typed out in a evening of impetuous writing that's become sort of like the only phrase that people will remember associated with my name.
You're young.
But the thing is, it was never meant as a sort of global accounting, which is the way the metaphor is now being used, as a global accounting of the Trump administration or Trump personally. It was meant as a very specific description of the way that executive order. And the thing is about the Trump administration is that there are many axes other than malevolence and incompetence around which to organize thought about them. And so I just want to tick off a couple of them. So, like, if the question is who's winning, malevolence or incompetence, the answer is you know, definitely incompetence. The administration has actually managed to get done relatively little in the malevolence department, largely because it can't get anything done. And that's actually, if you want to think of that as good news, I'll splash some cold water on that as well. But look, there are some other axes that may be more important than either malevolence or incompetence. One of them is evident clinical symptoms, right? And that, you know, insanity may be beating both malevolence and incompetence. This is not a president who is functioning in the normal way that we expect presidents to function. And whether you attribute that to something positive or to something negative, I think I actually think the best way to understand it, as Leon suggested, is clinical. But that factor, that unpredictability factor, that shoot from the hip, impetuosity factor, driven by whatever it's driven, probably is a very substantial determinant of a lot of things. The second area that I think is just, you know, driving a huge amount of the train, and I don't think it's quite either malevolence or incompetence, frankly, is personal obsession. So the president is personally obsessed in a way that is just dripping off of every interview he does with the question of other countries paying us. So if you read this Associated Press interview, they released the transcript of it, in reference to every single country whose leader he talked to, the issue of getting them to pay is front and center of his mind. He actually gets along just fine with Angela Merkel. He wants her to pay. He meets with the Prime Minister of Italy. They had a good relationship. They had great chemistry. He wants him to pay, right? Country by country. Now, is this malevolence or incompetence? It's a peculiar individual obsession on the part of the president with the quite literally transactional as in financial transactional relationships with other countries. Now, I think this is a very significant determinant of all sorts of things that the executive branch is doing right now, and it's simply a reflection of something that the president cares about that is, and evidently really cares about, that is sort of off of the normal spectrum of things that our leaders typically care about. So a third issue, which again I don't think of as necessarily either malevolence or incompetence, but is a real driver, is ego and narcissism. Now, whether this fits into the clinical or is its category of its own, you make your own decisions. But look, presidents as a class are not people with small egos. But they are usually capable of using the word we when they mean I, right? They are usually capable of talking about going through an interview without dominating the interview with the question of whether the press, how the press covers them individually. They're usually capable of at least trying to separate relations with foreign countries from the personal indignities that the leader of that country may, or the press in that country may, have subjected the president to. And they're usually capable of not congratulating themselves constantly by saying lots of people are saying X, when what you mean is that you wish that lots of people were saying X. And you know, the domination of the last 100 days, starting, by the way, with the first day of the administration, where the president, and I think, you know, in the department of sort of maintaining our shock I want to focus on this because, you know, on his first day in office, the president of the United States went to the CIA, stood in front of the memorial wall, and talked about the crowd size at his inauguration and the way the press had covered it. And that was how he chose to spend his first day. Now, I think that when that is the reality that you're dealing with, that is going to be distortive of all sorts of national security decisions, up to and including accusing your predecessor of wiretapping you, not merely without evidence of it, but in the face of evidence that it didn't happen, because you feel sort of like saying that in an impetuous moment. So I think that, you know, all of that is to say, I think this is a multi-axis discussion. Malevolence may be playing less a role than we all expected it to, certainly than I did. But there are a lot of other axes of distortion from what we would expect a normal foreign policy and national security regime and government to be functioning under. And the result of it is that the process and outcomes have been, on a very consistent basis, distorted and non-normal.
I want to spend a little bit of time in just a few minutes on the wiretapping claims, which I think that was actually a real turning point in the administration. But I want to go back first to this issue of the transactional nature of Donald Trump and the way that he seems to be executing, I hesitate to say a policy because I'm not sure it has given us evidence that it's that coherent, but what seems to be guiding his actions. And let me provoke you all with just this idea that, you know, he gave an interview recently where he said, I'm not going to label China a currency manipulator. Why would I do that? I need them to be helpful on North Korea. So really reversing himself in a major 180 on what had been a pretty central kind of point in how he was going to approach China. And he said, honestly, well, no, I need them for this thing now. So my provocation here would be like, why is that so bad? I mean, why is he not just practicing realpolitik and doing
that? I'll tell you why. Because transactionalism is contentless and ahistorical. When Trump was elected and I went searching for those regions of his mind that were not pure psychopathology, looking for ideology or a worldview or some framework of belief, the only thing I found was his belief in the deal. But the deal not just as a tactical maneuver, but as a view of the world. And when you promote deal making into a view of the world, and what you care about is winning, you have arrived at, as I say, a completely contentless place. So when he made that call, the famous call with the president or prime minister of Taiwan, when I read about that, first thing I thought to myself is that it was a butt call because there was no, obviously. Then it turned out that Bob Dole had arranged the butt call. So it was just but I was delighted because I find Taiwan to be an extraordinarily moving and supportable place. And I thought, oh, that's interesting. And then within 48 hours, he winds up telling, and of course the Taiwanese rejoiced because they were finally getting the kind of presidential attention that they've lacked. And then within 48 hours, he'd made it perfectly clear, however, that if the Chinese would give us a fair trade deal, we would be prepared to talk about Taiwan. In other words, what began as the premonition of a principled position or of a strategic vision for a region turned out to be simply a bargaining chip, a bargaining chip. And the idea that everything is a bargaining chip is much worse than realpolitik. Realpolitik, you have certain strategic ends. You justify them morally or you choose not to. Sometimes you justify them morally and you're faking it, but you have your interests. And you're pursuing them consistently and steadily, and in the case of some practitioners, even brilliantly, all right? But transactionalism is something much emptier than that, much more capricious than that, and much more, and again, the problem with Trump is that we keep going back to this clinical language, much more egocentric than that, if what you care about are the wins. Remember, this is a man who claims to come from capitalism. In fact, he comes from marketing, reality television, beauty pageants, and professional wrestling. Those are places in which all that matters are wins.
And, yeah. Actually, I think there's a more sort of even sort of fundamental point in what Leon's saying, all of which I agree with. And I think it's driving a lot of the anxiety that you're seeing, not just on stages like this, but sort of across Washington, D.C. And all around the world. And that's that Republicans and Democrats disagree on policy. They disagree on what the best thing for the United States is. But both Republican and Democratic presidents, we've always believed that they are acting in what they believe to be the best interest of the United States. And because of some of the combination of factors, one, a disregard for ethics rules and lack of transparency, two, a failure to articulate to the American people the reason for certain things, I think that there is a suspicion that these deals, these transactions that are being conducted, the ultimate aim of those transactions is not the best interest of the American people as the administration understands them, but instead the best interest of the Trump brand or of personal finances or of sort of cronyism. And, right, there's something, I think that there is a suspicion that sort of that infects lots and lots of interactions with the administration, some of which they've exacerbated, or much of which they've exacerbated, that is that there's a fundamental disconnect, even for people who can say, all right, you know, America first, and we should have this transactional approach, and they should be paying more of their fair share. Okay. The problem is that the administration hasn't articulated, you know, why would lifting sanctions on Russia be a good thing for the United States? Why would these things that we're doing, how does that actually benefit this country? And so whether it's a messaging disconnect, whether it's just a lack of trust because of the lack of transparency and disregard for some of those normative constraints, if not legal ones, I do think that that sort of underlies a lot of the I don't dislike or sort of instinctual rejection of this transactional view of things.
So I actually think that I think that there's still another underlying element, which is, so if the flip-flop on China and currency manipulation had taken place in a vacuum, which is just, I think we would all look at it and say, that's fine, or that's disgusting, but it's pretty normal. That is, every president runs for office on a tough on China policy and then flip-flops when they get into office because actually the relationship with China is big, complicated, multivariate, and basically not formulated according to principles. See Leon's earlier remarks. The problem here is that it took place against a backdrop of reversing all major positions, right? And so it takes place within a few days or weeks of going from Assad can stay in power and we can work to him with him to use of chemical weapons is completely unacceptable and we're going to bomb him and he needs to be removed, back to we have nothing to say about that. It comes against a backdrop of, as Leon pointed out, going, you know, meeting, talking to the Taiwanese president and then reaffirming the one China policy. It comes against a backdrop of NATO being obsolete and then it not being obsolete, right? I could go on, but this is actually what the military calls a target-rich environment. And when you are stating things in very strong terms all the time and then reversing yourself all the time, you don't get to then do what you just did, Shane, in formulating the question, which is to say, well, wait a minute, maybe the reversal is a good thing. Because the larger picture is that he's created an environment in which the words of the President of the United States don't mean anything at all. And that is a really dangerous proposition that, you know, nobody, he calls it unpredictability. There is some value to certain forms of unpredictability. But this isn't unpredictability, this is meaninglessness. And that's a very different thing, and it's a very dangerous
thing. But is it dangerous? I just want to ask you, is it dangerous because it will lead to misunderstanding and crisis, or is it, And I wonder sometimes if it just leaves us like in the neutral position and we just get nothing
done.
No,
so it's dangerous for three distinct, or maybe not distinct, interrelated reasons. The first is because there are certain things that the United States president needs to be able to say that everyone will take seriously in order for bad things not to happen. So when the
credibility.
Credibility. Yeah. The second is because we stand for certain principles. Now, we stand for them imperfectly. We stand for them sometimes hypocritically, but we stand for them. And, you know, when you create an environment in which nobody can take seriously anything the president of the United States says, and the statement of the president then has to be filtered through the subsequent contradiction by his senior staff in what is the most profound affront to the Hamiltonian unitary executive that we have ever seen in the history of the country. The president says something, Secretary of State contradicts it. The world relies on the Secretary of State, not the president. That is actually, if you think about that from the point of view of founding era thought, you know, the only proper response is seppuku. The third reason, and this is related to the first, is that, you know, we have a series of entrenched alliances. And short of those alliances, we have profound reliance interests that people and countries, by the way, some of them are countries, some of them are individual people, rely on the United States for. There were individual people who were given documents that said they got to enter the United States. The president of the United States said, you know, people from certain countries don't come in. They didn't get to come into the United States. You know, now that is the president of the United States reneging on promises made to individuals with the honor of the United States behind them. So it operates at the level of NATO, right, at the highest grand strategy level. It also operates at the level of some poor student who, you know, can't trust what the United States says anymore about his own or her own individual life because the president of the United States has a mood swing. And so I think, you know, there are probably other reasons that I'm not thinking of off the top of my head, but those are three.
Okay.
Yeah. I just wanted to add two things. First, just to what my friend Ben just said, as a consequence of all the things that he said, that we've said, there is definitely out there in the greater planet Earth a feeling of sovkipa that the United States, and this began with Obama, by the way, that the United States can no longer be really relied upon in a crisis, that the cavalry will never come again, that alliances are regarded more as burdens than as privileges, that alliances are based mainly, thought of mainly transactionally and not philosophically or et cetera, et cetera. And the consequence of this feeling of sovkipa, there's a practical consequence, which is that more and more places are turning to Putin, because Putin turns out to be pretty damn reliable. And Sisi goes to Moscow, Netanyahu goes to Moscow, everybody goes to Moscow, because if they're looking for positions in the new international game, more and more people are beginning to think that it may be advantageous to strike deals, make bargains with our enemy and a nefarious power. The second thing I wanted to say is to add to what you said, and I think it's very important when you mention Republicans and Democrats, the Trump entropy, let's call it, in foreign policy and national security takes place against a political context in which thinking on both these questions in both parties has broken down or gotten completely discombobulated. I mean, even though Trump was the Republican candidate, so the Republicans won the presidential election, the fact is that after this campaign, both parties are broken down. And in foreign policy and national security, the situation is even more incoherent. On domestic questions, some of them retain a certain degree of ideological elan and ideological vitality on questions of economic inequality and immigration and economics and so on. On foreign policy and national security, we're living in a bizarre world. I mean, all of a sudden, Democrats fall over themselves adoring the intelligence agencies, right? Where and Republicans believe you can't trust the word they say. But more importantly, the arguments for interventionism, for liberal internationalism, for the idea of American, that American power can be used for good in the world, these arguments are in retreat on both parties. Now, you may not like those arguments, and you may celebrate this retreat, but what I sense is that both parties need to develop a discussion of foreign policy and national security at the level of first principles, at the level of first principles, because everything is confused and muddled and unclear, and that, so there's no leadership that will come from the parties, and there's no leadership that will come from the White House. And so we find ourselves, so they don't rule on this, these matters, we're like a banana republic that, that consoles itself with the fact that we still have an independent judiciary. That's approximately where we are now.
So if we're taking all of this, the past 100 days, this is what we've learned and where we are now and kind of where this deposits us in this particular moment today is a brewing crisis on the Korean Peninsula. I think it's abundantly clear at this point that the intelligence community has essentially assessed that North Korea has probably two out of the three legs that it would need to develop a nuclear weapon capable of hitting somewhere in the continental United States. We can talk about the Carl Vinson episode and what that maybe reveals about the coherence or lack thereof. But if you were having to sort of take stock of this now and bet where we go in the next 2 weeks to 2 months even on North Korea, I mean, what are you thinking? What is this? What is this? What kind of ideas does this provoke or anxieties in your minds?
I mean, obviously the anxieties that it provokes are sort of ones of nuclear incineration and, you know, terror. Like, this is the ultimate high stakes thing. The probability of the worst case scenarios involving North Korea strike me as remaining pretty low. On the other hand, and I have some, you know, and again, in an example of even when they do things that you approve of, it's very hard to note, it's very hard to celebrate that. I have a lot of sympathy with what the Trump administration seems to be trying to do with North Korea, which is to take a different, more aggressive approach than the last three administrations, which collectively have an unremitting record of failure in reining in the North Korean nuclear weapons program. And so if the question is, you know, do I have sympathy with the idea that we should, as the stakes are now reaching a critical point, take a very firm line? Yeah, I think we should, and I'm sympathetic to the administration on that. On the other hand, it does not give you confidence that in the context of executing such a policy, they lose an aircraft carrier, right? It doesn't give you confidence that in the context of executing such a policy, there are statements that are all over the place, and that the president announces that he'd really never realized until the Chinese premier explained it to him that Korea is complicated and that Korea used to be part of China, which, by the way, did not go over well in South Korea. And so, you know, you have this problem, even if you start with a point of view of sympathy for the sort of more active posture that they're taking, that they don't seem to be able to do anything well. And when you do this particular thing badly, it is a game that involves nukes. It's a game that involves 10,000 artillery pieces trained on a city of 10 million plus people. And it is a game where the person on the other end of the game is as impetuous, maybe more impetuous, as crazy and as ego-driven as our president is, and by the way, is something additionally that our president is not, which is murderous and incredibly violent. And so I think it's an extremely dangerous situation, and I think the only hopeful thing to say is that the situation may have a certain logic. The logic of the situation may have some degree of its own stability in it, but I'm not, I wouldn't put a lot of faith in that.
Susan, can I ask you a question on the, just briefly before we go to questions, too, and Leanna, I want you to chime in, too, on this, but what happens when the president, if he has to go to the American public and say, my intelligence community has told me that the North Koreans are preparing to ready a missile that can hit San Francisco, and this is the same president who told us that we shouldn't trust the intelligence community and whatever they said about his ties to Russia because these are the people who got weapons of mass destruction in Iraq so profoundly wrong. What is that moment like when he has to go to people and say, well, no, now I trust them and I want you
about
to,
weapons of mass
about
destruction.
Weapons of mass destruction and I want to go to war.
Right. I mean, so he's actually already had that moment whenever he comes forward and says, you know, we have high confidence that there were chemical weapons used in Syria, high confidence that's an intelligence assessment. So I think it's the this incredibly short-sighted, frankly, war on the intelligence community that really has existed in the campaign period and has endured into his presidency. That is a really, really short-sighted thing. It raises real questions about why it's happening, why there is this sort of instinctual hostility to this community that exists to serve the American people, exists to serve the president. I think the bigger issue at this point is going to be credibility on the international stage and the ability to actually take action and to rally our allies and to not have and to have other countries fall in line the way they have in the past. You know, I think what we're seeing is everybody wants to avoid a crisis. And so, you know, other political actors, Congress will move out of the way when the president sort of gets out of line because they want to avoid the crisis. And sometimes the judiciary will move out of line. And geopolitically, different nations will sort of help give each other space because nobody wants the really bad thing to happen. And that works. And so it allows sort of the trampling of norms and for people to sort of run roughshod over, you know, some firmly established lines. And the problem is it works until it doesn't, right? And I think that North Korea is the area in which it's the most consequential and maybe sort of the most immediate area in which there seems to be a real possibility that nobody moves out of the way in that circumstance. You know, I think that the president will come to regret any action he's taken to undermine his intelligence community, paired with his own lack of credibility. This has the sort of the makings of a real disaster.
Okay.
Well, the good news is that Jared Kushner's in the Situation Room. I mean, so I think things will be fine.
It's all going to be good.
I think it will be good. Okay. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You're going to be really happy. Don't worry.
Yeah, well, it's going to be great.
It's going to be beautiful.
It's going to be great.
Everyone's going to be really pleased.
No, look, I think that on Korea, and I'm by far from an expert on this, it seems to me that the question of China's relationship to Korea is historically, morally, and humanly more consequential to everyone in the region and to us than the question of the Chinese currency or their trade policy. Trump, being who he is he economicizes all issues.
Yeah.
By the way, many people in this city and this country have for years now been economicizing all issues for various reasons. But that's his comfort zone. You know, he wants, I mean, you said that he wants allies to pay. I'm thinking, well, he understands the problem because for so many decades he was on the other side of that debate. And I think that if we, with allies and with the diplomatic talent that we have, it seems to me that the only way to solve this in a way that will not lead to conflagration is to make it clear to the Chinese that we really are serious. Now, it's heretical, and certainly in this building, it's heretical to suggest that one should take a very forthright and somewhat impatient, let's say, policy towards China in various regards. There is this view that China is a given, that we need their goodwill, we need their money, they're a quarter of the world's population, they're the greatest market that God ever created on earth, et cetera, et cetera. I think it is the Korean crisis should now force us to think about our China policy from a different framework, where the stakes are infinitely higher. The Chinese, as far as I can tell, are playing a dirty game in Korea. They really are. I don't quite understand it, I have to say. they can't possibly want war on their border, and they can't possibly want nuclear war. But they're playing a dirty game. They remind me of the Qataris and the Saudis in Syria and other places who are on both sides of the policy of the crisis. And I think that the first important diplomatic test of the Trump administration will be whether or not McMaster, who I'm sure understands this, and Mattis, whom I presume understands this, and Tillerson, who's now reading a book about China. I hope that we can somehow arrive at some rethinking of this strategy. It will happen it won't happen because of the president. It will happen despite the president. And if it works, the president will take credit for it. I used to think about Trump that the good news and the bad news about Trump is that the only thing he cares about is popularity. So if he discovers that taking candy from children forces his numbers to go down, he'll stop doing that. And if he discovers that giving candy to children pushes his numbers up, he'll give candy to children. It's sort of like Scrooge in some sort of way. But this is a policy that I hope the people in government right now are, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah. All right, let's turn to you all in the audience. Please raise your hand if you would have a question. It's right here. And, I'm sorry, the mic will come to you, and please wait for the mic because this is being webcast, so people at home can hear you too.
Stuart Brown, Warren Capital. I have a question about rule by executive order, how this president ranks with others, and are there any checks on that, or are we to look forward to another 3+ years of rule by executive order?
I mean, the irony here is, of course, this is a principal critique that the Republicans had against President Obama, who relied heavily on executive orders in the face of sort of an uncooperative Congress. The primary check on the use of executive orders is the judiciary. And I think if there's one interesting or reassuring signal here is that we're seeing, in response to the executive order, a very, very muscular sort of judiciary that is pushing back on sort of assertions of executive deference in ways that we haven't seen in a very long time. So I think potentially if there's a silver lining, it's a recalibration. We see the judiciary occupying a little bit more of its constitutional role. It seems silly to even say it, but maybe Congress will step up to occupy a little bit more of its constitutional role, especially in regard to sort of the war-making powers. Ben, I don't know if you have a different take on it.
Well, I think the president's authority in the national security realm is vast. And that means that whether using the formal structure of the executive order or some other authority that's within his power, he has enormous latitude to do an incredible variety of things. And by the way, he's invented some new forms of executive exertions of authority, including the tweet, which we hadn't previously realized was a major instrument of executive authority. But it is, actually. You can shape the world as president by tweeting, including tweeting false information. There's a special codicil of Article 2 of the Constitution that gives the president that power. And I don't think that's actually controllable. The president gets to name crazy people to senior positions. That's not an authority that Congress has the ability to limit to the extent that those are not Senate-confirmed positions. The president has the authority to choose to focus on X issue transactionally, who pays us, versus Y issue, which the entire rest of the world might think is more important. There's nothing you can do to stop that. So while I do think it's important for, other actors to play their functions, at the end of the day, the presidency matters a great deal. And we elected somebody for 4 years who's going to remind us of that every day.
Leon, did you want to add?
I yield to lawfare. No.
Question here. Yes, sir, over here. Right here on the left.
Good morning. My name is Christian Herbel. I'm a student from Europe, from European University of Jedidina. And my question is easy. What gonna Trump do with Putin? Do they become good friends, or he makes a deal through Ukraine to make peace in Syria? What do you think about that?
The Trump-Putin bromance.
Well, I mean, like with the strike in Syria, I was absolutely delighted that they broke up. I hope neither guy's feelings were too hurt. But I have no reason to believe that this will be a consistent policy or that it's based on any larger reading of history or interests or values. I think that the ascendancy of Putin in our time is the single most surprising fact about our time and probably the single most dangerous fact. If you had said 25 years ago that in 2017 China will be a very powerful country with military ambitions and growing economic power globally, we would have agreed. And if you had said 25 years ago that in 2017 the Middle East would be in flames for one reason or another, we would have been sad, but we would have agreed. But if you had said that in 2017 Russia would be the ascendant global power and this KGB thug would preside over a renaissance of Russian nationalism and revive Russian regional and global centrality and would successfully and brazenly interfere in the democratic processes of Western countries and would seize territory from a country and invade a country, et cetera, and I haven't even gotten to Syria yet. If you had said that all this would be the case, I think we would have been laughed at. I certainly would have laughed. So I think that given the grotesque relationship or feel, I don't know what the relationship was, the grotesque attitude that Trump had to Putin throughout the campaign, which was one of probably maybe the most disgraceful aspect of that disgraceful campaign, though the competition's rough. I think it's a healthy development. Now, will it last? What is it based on? I have no idea. There is no way to know. It's perfectly clear that Europe, and we'll use that for as long as we can still speak of Europe, we'll use the term Europe, is looking for American leadership to cement a new front against Russia, which I think is absolutely necessary. Just as for a long time during Obama, and now it was clear to me, that there was a pro-American alliance along the East Pacific and the Pacific Rim on the part of countries that were getting actually very worried about the Chinese. And the question is whether we have the values, the will, and the talent to actually act diplomatically in this regard. When it came to Syria, our policy towards Russia and Syria has been one of deconfliction, right? That was our objective. And to which I think to myself, you know what, we're the United States of America. Let them worry when we fly or not.
I always disagree with Leon at my peril. The one thing is that I'm not sure that we should be viewing Russia as this ascendant global power. Mm. I think that they were desperate and reckless and got lucky in this one instance. Massively lucky. We're going to have a really hard conversation, one, about getting to ground truth on what exactly occurred. It's clear we're going to have to do that over the obstruction and objection of the White House.
With the interference in the election, you mean?
Yeah. Exactly. The other hard question we're going to have is what exactly was going on in American society that made us vulnerable to those kinds of attacks. That's going to be a much more difficult long-term fix, but that's really going to be the most important part.
But you see, but the geostrategic situation, I mean, I agree with every word you said, but the geostrategic situation is not the same thing as the question of Russian interference in our election. Russia is now advancing steadily along various fronts according to a certain view of its own interests in the Middle East, in North Africa, in Eastern Europe, in Western Europe. It's just a matter of days before we wake up in the morning and hear that somebody important from Moscow has met with Maduro. The Russian relationship to Iran is one of enormous geostrategic consequence. So whether or not they did or they didn't, and we all know that they did, that actually interests me less than the rest of the world.
Okay, we've reached the end of our time. Susan, Leon, Ben, thanks for doing this.
Oh,
thanks for being here. Thank you all.
You can disagree with me as often as
I find out one or two more.
Boom, 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 to the middle, just to go tax, tax. All right. I think we'll go ahead and begin here. Is everyone feeling optimistic after that panel? The good news on this panel is that we will not start any nuclear wars. So thank you all for being here. I'm Ben Castleman. I'm an editor and writer with 538. And we're gathered at an interesting moment. I think interesting is a safe comment. An interesting moment on tax and regulatory policy. In particular, it's been an eventful first 100 days and looks like it's going to be an eventful right up to the end of that 100-day mark. As I'm sure many of you saw on Friday, President Trump signed a number of memorandums and executive orders relating to financial regulation and to tax regulation. And it sounds like this week we may get kind of our first glimpse of at least the broad outlines of a tax plan, although nobody seems too sure on what any of that is going to actually hold. I'm sure we'll get into some of those details over the course of this panel, but I sort of want to set out two questions that I'm hoping will frame this a little bit. The first of those is sort of how likely we are to see fundamental change in either of these areas under this administration and this Congress, not just sort of one-off tax cuts or rollbacks of loopholes, not just the rollback of a couple of Obama administration regulations, but the kind of fundamental reform that we were promised on the campaign trail and that, frankly, we've been promised by members of both parties in one way or another on campaign trails for the last several cycles. And then secondly, to the extent that we do see change, large or small, does that fit into this sort of traditional framework of, for lack of a better word here, sort of normal Republican reform, or do we see something different in some way? And whether you want to call that different thing populism or economic nationalism or assign some other word to it. So I'm hoping that we'll be able to get into sort of both of those as overarching questions on this. We have a wonderful panel here today to help us wade through those questions and others. Vanessa Williamson at my far left here is a fellow in governance studies here at the Brookings Institution, where she studies public attitudes towards taxation. She previously served as policy director at the Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America. And her new book is titled Read My Lips, Why Americans Are Proud to Pay Taxes. She has a doctorate from Harvard. Philip Wallach is senior fellow in governance studies at Brookings, where he has written about regulatory issues, particularly environmental and financial regulation. His recent work examines the legitimacy challenge facing the U.S. administrative state. He holds a PhD from Princeton. And Louise Scheiner, to my immediate left, is Senior Fellow in Economic Studies and Policy Director at the Hutchins Center on Fiscal and Monetary Policy, again here at the Brookings Institution. She's previously worked at the Federal Reserve Board of Governors, at U.S. Treasury Department, the Council of Economic Advisors, and she holds a doctorate in education from Harvard. So thank you all three of you, in economics, excuse me. She has an education from Harvard. So Louise, I wanted to start with you. Tax reform, and especially corporate tax reform, seems to be one of these things that everybody agrees is necessary from both sides of the aisle, and yet it never happens. According to our Treasury Secretary, it's a lot simpler than healthcare reform, but the evidence on that is outstanding, I guess. So I'm curious sort of why this is so difficult, and to the extent that there may be a path towards some kind of agreement, what that might actually look like.
Yeah, so I mean, tax reform sounds easy until you start looking at the details, and then it gets difficult, just like health reform. It is quite different, I agree with you, than health reform, where at least the diagnosis of the problem is commonly shared, right? So the U.S. corporate tax is the highest among the OECD partners. We have a tax system that supposedly taxes worldwide income, but allows for a ton of income not being taxed or being taxed at much lower rates because there are loopholes, because of gimmicks. And so I think everybody agrees that it's a problem. And then in particular, we also worry that our tax system is pushing U.S. companies to move headquarters overseas to become foreign companies. So we agree on the problem. And the Obama administration had a corporate tax proposal. So that's different than health reform, where we don't even agree on the basic facts on the ground. But then when you try to think about where do you go from here, it becomes very difficult. And I think three basic reasons. If you think about tax reform, what people often mean about tax reform is not just a tax cut, but really, as you say, a sort of essential change in how we tax. So the House Republicans have something, a proposal that I would call real tax reform, where you're really, really changing the way corporate and business income is taxed, where it's going to depend on where the products are sold rather than where they're produced. So it's very, very different. If you want to have a tax reform that isn't just a tax cut, but that is revenue neutral, right, that says we're going to lower taxes in some areas, we're going to have to raise them in other, we're going to get rid of loopholes, we're going to get rid of the gimmicks, then what happens is you split the business community, right? There are winners and there are losers. And once you've done that, it makes it very, very difficult to pass, right? So I'll take an example. In the House Republican tax reform plan, they have this border-adjusted tax, this BAT you've probably heard about, right? And what that appears to do, economists would argue that it doesn't, but what that appears to do is to tax importers and subsidize exporters. So a retailer like Walmart that imports, you know, most of its stuff is firmly against it. So not only are they against it in terms of saying this is bad for our business, but they say it's going to raise prices on consumers. Right? So a congressman and a lot of their voters shop at Walmart is going to have a hard time voting for that. So because there are winners and losers, it just makes it very, very difficult for everybody to get on board, right? So that makes it hard. It's not as hard if you say, you know what, we don't have to be revenue neutral. We can make some of these reforms and, you know, let it pass through and increase the deficit. Well, that becomes difficult for other reasons. So certainly at this point in time, with the debt already very high, there are people in the Republican Congress who would not easily vote for something that increased deficits. Procedurally, it's difficult as well because in the Senate, if something increases deficits beyond the 10-year window, you have to have 60 votes unless they change those rules, which would mean that you couldn't do it just with Republicans, so that becomes difficult. And I think on top of that, at this point in the business cycle, it's a lot harder to argue that we need to cut taxes in order to spur the economy, right? So we're kind of at full employment. The Fed is raising interest rates. You kind of lose that argument. So it's easier to get those kinds of tax cuts when everybody says, well, we need to do something, right? And then I think the third reason that it's hard, you know, as we said, both Republicans and Democrats want to do something, but cutting business taxes, corporate taxes, individual business taxes, tends to be distributionally tilted towards the wealthy. Right? So the only way the Democrats would sign on is if you had something that was really had a lot of benefits, a lot of, you know, it doesn't have to be taxes, but it could be taxes or ACA subsidies or like for the people in the middle and lower income classes. It's not clear to me that the Republicans would give enough to make the Democrats want to do that, especially because we've got 2018 on the horizon, and people said, well, you know, what if we just wait? Maybe, you know, this will be a do-nothing Congress, and we could take over the House. So I think for those reasons, it just makes it incredibly difficult.
Vanessa, one of the things that you have written is that one of the obstacles to reform is that Americans hold some pretty fundamental misunderstandings of how our tax system even works. So I'm curious what some of those misconceptions are and how that affects this tax debate.
Yeah, great question. So I think it's important to start by saying that, you know, because tax policy is very complicated, it's common for smart and educated and even very politically engaged people to hold misconceptions about tax reform, right? So I think that it's important to sort of recognize that that's a problem that's not just limited to certain kinds of people. But right, it's true that Americans do hold these really fundamental misunderstandings. One of them, well, a lot of them are on the individual tax side, but the distinction in the average person's mind between the individual income tax and the corporate income tax is not very strong. People tend to group together corporations and the wealthy as people who don't pay their share. And whether you believe that or not, if they don't pay their share, it's not for the same reasons, right? It's a completely separate code. So you have to sort of recognize that people know very, very little about corporate taxation in general. The only piece of it that I think is widely understood, or at least widely even that people are even aware of, is the idea that some companies are hiding their money overseas. But of course, the details of a policy that would address that and which kind of policy would address that in a way that aligns with any given voter's values is extremely difficult to say, right? I mean, even experts disagree on these subjects. The other piece of sort of public misconception that I think may play a real role this year is a tendency for people to perceive loopholes and not rates as the thing that really matters for public opinion or for the tax rate that you pay. So, for instance, people often misunderstand a plan that closes loopholes but lowers rates as something that's going to end up revenue neutral, when in fact, you know, obviously you can close some loopholes and lower the rates and end up costing a lot of money, right, blowing a big hole in the budget, and many of those plans that gets proposed do that. So I think that people tend to misperceive what kind of policies will implement their values. And that, I think, is especially true when they're trying to understand tax policies that don't affect, you know, most Americans at all in any immediate way, in any direct way, so that they're really operating with the best information they can get from their very polarized news sources, right? So you face a big partisan divide on that.
A lot more we can get into on tax, but I want to shift to regulation for one second to Philip here. Because unlike with tax, where it's been all talk so far, on regulation we've actually seen some stuff happen. We've seen a number of regulations get rolled back through the Congressional Review Act. We've seen this new policy of one in, two out that the president signed as one of his first acts in office. We've seen a number of other Obama-era regulations either suspended or under review. So I'm sort of curious, just take us through the first 100 days. How much action has there been, and kind of what does that tell us about the regulatory approach of this administration going forward?
Well, the first thing to mention is the Congressional Review Act that you noted. So that has a time-limited window, 60 legislative days since a rule was finalized. So that leaves a lot of Obama administration rules that were vulnerable to having Congress pass this procedurally advantaged disapproval resolution, and then the president has signed those. So 13 rules from the Obama administration have been wiped off the books through that mechanism so far, and the White House even sort of had a press briefing saying, hey, everybody, take note of this. This is a big deal. Only one rule had ever been wiped off the books in this way before, and we've done it more than a dozen times now. Those don't tend to have been really big blockbuster rules, though, because the Obama administration sort of sheltered its most important rules by getting them passed earlier. On a lot of those fronts, you know, there's a lot of important stuff that the Obama administration did through executive orders or guidance documents, and the Trump administration is able to just, you know, with their pen and their phone, wipe those out, and have done so on quite a lot of things. For other ones, such as the Clean Power Plan, which I, one of the regulations that was the most controversial that I study, we've seen the Trump administration take a somewhat more cautious approach. They put out an executive order saying, we're going to reassess this rule, and they're going to observe all of the niceties of the Administrative Procedure Act in going through and reconsidering that. There'll be a notice and comment process, and we have a pretty good idea where they're going to end up, but they're going to be legally careful about that. So in a lot of those ways, we've sort of seen the opening moves rather than everything. So then the question is, on the bigger picture stuff, reshaping the way regulations get made. So the Trump administration has put in place this one-in, two-out rule by executive order, but it's really hard to understand exactly what that's going to do still. The rule says, the executive order says, this is not going, should not be interpreted as being inconsistent with any statutory requirements. So that means presumably any rule that is mandated by statute cannot be wiped off just because this policy is in place. So we're going to have to see how OMB Director Mulvaney and the new the nominee for the head of OIRA, Naomi Rao, figure out what to do with that exactly. And likewise with the regulatory budget that's also a part of that same executive order where the administration says they're going to aspire to zero net costs for all of the regulations that they are going to implement. So that's on the executive branch side. What can they do themselves? We have to see how that'll all work out. Then we have the congressional side, and really I think a lot of this stuff on regulation is of greater interest to Congress than it is to the White House in some ways. And so Congress has endured 8 years of the Obama administration where they felt, or at least 6 years with the Republican majority in the House, where they felt very marginalized, and they've been passing reforms through the House for many years now that would really significantly restructure the regulatory process. And so they've now passed some of those same ones through the House again. The real action is in the Senate, where it's not clear if you can count up to 60 votes on some of those. You might be able to, or what you could work through reconciliation somehow. But that's where the real action is going to be this upcoming summer, I'd say.
I'm curious just to delve down on that slightly, and I'd love Luis and Vanessa to weigh in on this as well. We've seen a sort of flurry of undoing right in the beginning of this administration, and we know that the Obama administration relied heavily on executive action, especially in the last 6 years. Now we're sort of seeing the fundamental impermanence of that on some level. But the early days of the Trump administration have also been very focused on executive action. We obviously haven't seen anything really in the way of legislation. Are we heading towards a place where there's just much more sort of back and forth every time there's a change of control versus a little bit more of the permanence that we might have been used to some degree on the regulatory side?
I mean, you're sort of talking from my book as far as I'm concerned. I mean, the way that the Constitution sets up our policymaking process, really to achieve any degree of stability, it needs to go through Congress and congressional enactment of statutes. And the more that becomes something that administrations in the White House try to do without and circumvent, the more that we set ourselves up for a regime of policy instability where there's reversals after reversals and really very little policy certainty, which is obviously very economically destabilizing.
I mean, I think that comes from the polarization that we've seen, that it's not because they don't want to use the congressional process, but that's such a broken process that there's so much disagreement. You know, trying to get 60 votes for anything in this administration is going to be very difficult. And so, you know, and it was in the last administration as well. So, you know, I think that, so I totally agree that we will see more of that, and that's because that's kind of all they have at their disposal that they can actually easily get done. So,
yeah, just to follow up on that, I think it's one troubling aspect of it is that I think it has a little bit of a self-reinforcing mechanism where because if you're in the administration, you can't get what you want done through Congress, then you're obliged to use executive orders, but then you take very polarized positions, right? And that sort of reinforces a sort of zero-sum game for the next iteration as well. So you end up with, I don't see how to bring that back in the, you know, more traditional governance direction as opposed to it sort of spiraling outward into increased polarization.
But I kind of framed this conversation at the outset by saying, how likely are we to see fundamental change versus sort of smaller pieces? And I'm curious to sort of set a benchmark here. If we can go down the line and assign a probability, we will then hold you to that, absolutely, because we like holding people to probabilities at 538. But try to just lay out a probability of sort of major reform in either of these areas. We'll just go down the line quickly.
Okay, so on tax reform, I think a really major reform is unlikely. I'm going to give it, and I think the BAT has got maybe a less than 5% chance of something a little bit bigger, you know, still very, very unlikely. I think the probability that they get something, a tax cut, I mean, again, you have Republican administration, Republican control both houses of the Senate, could not deliver. I don't think they will be able to deliver on the ACA repeal. You know, the desire to pass something to bring home to the constituents, I think, will be large. So I think I would give some kind of corporate tax cut, maybe sunsetting after 10 years, you know, whatever, a 60% chance and like 35% of nothing much happening.
I like it. All right.
I think Republicans will be able to get on the same page about something again in regulatory process reform. So I think there will be a big law passed, possibly as soon as, later this year. The one that has the most traction right now is the Regulatory Accountability Act. I wouldn't want to bet on particular horses, but yeah, I'd say I think there's a 75% chance they'll be able to come together on something. I do think there's a lot of other areas where they may end up in conflict and find out that their consensus isn't so deep.
Yeah, I have to admit, I basically just agree with Louise. By far, I think the most likely scenario is a substantial tax cut that is not tax reform. I think that's by far the most likely thing, and I think you're absolutely right that it's not likely to end up being revenue neutral. It's likely to sunset instead.
So if we're not likely to see kind of the big whack at tax reform, Vanessa, maybe start with you. What are we likely to see? What kinds of cuts are we likely to actually see?
Yeah,
cuts or loophole closings, whatever.
Well, so one interesting question is what's going to happen about the tax cuts that were supposed to be in the ACA repeal.
Right.
So that's one thing that, you know, I think I would have thought was quite likely a couple of months ago, once the election was completed, that was something you were likely to see change on tax. And now I think that's much less clear. I think they'll probably want to do something about the money that's overseas and bringing that back at some preferential rate. Other than that, I don't think that it's clear at all. I think, you know, the sort of big pieces of reform are pretty unlikely, particularly the ones that raise taxes or divide the business community. I think that's exactly the pieces that are at the bottom of the list for me.
Other smaller things either of you think are likely?
I'm going to basically agree with Vanessa. What I'm not sure about is whether or not they're going to end up doing, if they do something at all, whether or not they're going to have an individual tax reform and corporate at the same time, or they're just going to do some lowering the rates on corporate, doing something like bringing back, you know, having a repatriation holiday, maybe, you know, some minor chipping at the edges of certain things. Although, so one of the things that I might have thought they would do would be trying to do some things to limit interest deductibility, which is one of the gimmicks that corporations use to move profits overseas. One of the rules that they just decided that they were going to oversee is what the Treasury Department had already issued in trying to do that. So it's really unclear. And I mean, it's really unclear because what you're hearing from the White House and Treasury, you don't even know who's in charge. I mean, so what we're going to hear on Wednesday, I mean, does it matter? Is it really what they've thought? You know, there's no sense, again, you know, I was listening to the previous panel, this idea of having sort of fundamental values from this administration. We don't really know what their fundamental values are and what they want to do or why. So I don't know. No, I don't have anything else.
Just to briefly follow up on that, I mean, yeah, a lot of this depends on how unified does the Republican caucus turn out to be on any of this stuff. You know, Trump had the potential to really bring in some disruptive ideas, whether those end up just getting spat out such that we're sort of back in a world that Paul Ryan circa 2014 would be at home in, or whether the Republican coalition is in a position of having to digest some kind of more fundamental tensions now.
The inversions piece, which I think you're referring to from Friday, is sort of striking as something that President Trump spoke about on the campaign trail. It's something that, you know, seemed to sort of fit into his populist agenda to say to go against this, and then we obviously saw him go sort of totally the other direction on Friday. I mean, what should we make of?
So, I mean, I think this idea of going totally in the other direction is a common theme you might have for this administration. And if you think about the people they've put in place to do economic policies, as opposed to other, you know, agencies, EPA or Justice or something, are really people who would be comfortable in Paul Ryan's world, right? I mean, are people from Goldman Sachs, are people who are in sync with the business community, you know, except for Peter Navarro, and but who seems to have been kind of sidelined. And so I don't think that Trump cares enough about the details or really wants to understand the details, that sort of what he said on the campaign trail, you know, necessarily matters that much. So I think if we see anything, it'll be much more like Paul Ryan-style tax change, I think, than something kind of really different. And I think that's more true on economic policy than perhaps on other policies.
Although the one thing that Paul Ryan sort of really explicitly wanted on tax reform is border-adjusted taxes. It looks like he's not going to get that.
Right. So I don't mean what Paul Ryan himself wants, because I think he's not going to get that, but sort of what a standard Republican plan might be, which is what you sort of start off with, which would be, let's lower taxes on investment, let's lower taxes on business, I think is what you're going to find, and not this let's make sure that corporations have to pay if they want to leave, you know, the stuff that was on the campaign, right. The stuff that when it gets proposed or even talked about, they'll say, oh, that's going to be terrible for business and that's going to be terrible for, you know, investment, and I think it gets dropped. But.
Is that true on the regulatory side as well, Philip, that we're...
So I do think there's a lot, there are a lot of potential institutional conflicts between Congress and the executive branch in any political environment, and that's certainly true here. But I do think that the sort of this is one of the easier issues for Republicans to hold hands and get along on. You know, I think there's a possibility that there will be blowback at some point, that sort of people will say, hey, Trump, you're just serving business interests after all this populist rhetoric. What gives with that? But I do think that for now there's this harmonization. Well, we have to allow U.S. businesses to thrive and get rid of these regulatory barriers, and that's the way of promoting U.S. jobs. And that sort of rolls into a fairly coherent narrative that they can run with for a while.
Curious on both of these sets of issues, how true you think that assumption is, that there are the existing tax and regulatory structure are holding back the U.S. economy in sort of a fundamental way, and to the extent that it is, sort of what areas you see as the biggest tension points there. Philip, we'll start with you.
Yeah. So I have some sympathy. I mean, it's very hard to assess quantitatively or counterfactually, you know, what would the world be like with a whole lot less federal regulation. But I do have the sense that we have this layers and layers of accreted regulations that really do create some serious barriers. We have a lot of regulations that are not very discriminating in whether they apply to very small businesses versus big businesses. Certainly in community banking is one that gets a lot of emphasis. And so I think there should be kind of like a bipartisan space for doing some regulatory pruning that would be very productive for helping the U.S. economy. Of course, everything is so polarized, it's always hard to find that bipartisan space, But yeah, I think there's some real truth to it. And so when Trump reaches for some of these things that do seem kind of gimmicky, like the one in, two out kind of thing, I have some kind of sympathy for saying, well, you just need to create some kind of forcing mechanism where we say we're going to force bureaucrats to go in and reckon with what the existing laws on the books are doing, and whether those are really cost-effective. Because a lot of times we just do cost-benefit analysis when we put regulations in place, and then we don't really return to them all that much later. So there's a lot of crudeness in that two-for-one approach, but it does seem like doing something to try to confront the regulatory burden makes sense.
Louise?
Yeah, so I basically agree with that. And I think that you know, if we're looking for something that's going to be, oh, we just do this and then we're going to have so much growth, we're going to have so many jobs, like, there's no silver bullet like that. And so this idea that, you know, that every reg, you know, that if a reg's costs are greater than its benefits, we should get rid of it and we should have a process that thinks about that. I think that's right. You know, would I go there first, if I said, what would you, if you were, you know, what, if you could make changes, is that where you would focus? I wouldn't. And, you know, again, on the corporate taxes, I think, you know, it is a problem. It will have, need to be addressed at some point. But I also don't think it's going to be like, you know, if we get rid of corporate taxes, we're going to have this, you know, huge increase in investment and a huge increase in jobs. I wouldn't go there. You know, when I think about where I would go to areas where, I mean, my view is that the biggest problem that we have is rising inequality, which I think also contributes to potentially slower productivity growth, and I would go to things that address that. I would go to things like make sure we invest in poor kids, you know, make sure they don't have lead in their water. You know, sort of these are obvious ones that I think are more important that aren't getting the attention. I would think about antitrust, because I think there's some idea that maybe the productivity slowdown might be related to this increased concentration. And then I would think about things that I don't know how much the federal government has in terms of regulation, but I think there is some evidence that sort of the reduction in geographic mobility, it's very hard for people to move to cities where there is productivity, where there is growth because of zoning issues that makes housing too expensive. I don't know if there's a way for that, and that's increased potentially regulation. And I don't know if there's a way for the federal government to have a role there, but those places I would look. I wouldn't really look to these issues as much. But again, you want to do things that make sense, and everything at the margin can help. So,
yeah, I would just definitely second your point about the sort of challenge of monopoly or relatively few actors in markets. Obviously, that is not the best approach to encourage competition and, you know, investment and all these things. I think that we have that issue in a lot of sectors now. I also think that, you know, this is not something that this that's particularly likely to happen in the near future, but I think that one challenge we also face is that with lower tax rates at the top, it encourages it encourages certain kinds of rent seeking, basically, among executives, so that they are less interested in investing in their companies and more interested in providing bigger dividends to their stockholders. So. Their shareholders. So I think that that's those are a couple of challenges where I think that there's probably room for regulation that is not particularly likely to happen in the near future, but I think it could be an important part of building an economy that was growing and was growing for more people.
One thing that's kind of amazing to me here is the way that we glossed over this revenue neutrality thing. I think if we'd been having this conversation a few years ago, we would not have just sort of, especially with a Republican Congress and a Republican president, we would not have just sort of said, oh, and I don't think it's going to be budget neutral. Although we saw during the campaign, of course, that sort of the deficit was hardly something that came up during the last campaign. I'm curious sort of how we got to that place and how that changes this debate in, as opposed to if we were sort of insisting on that in a way that we have historically. Louise, maybe you can...
Well, so I think if we were insisting on revenue neutrality, we, you know, would be even more likely not to do anything because it's not, as I said, it's very difficult. It's very difficult to have some people be losers when other people are winners, right? So I think that, you know, there's a question. I think one of the big unknowns in terms of whether or not the Republicans can act unified is whether the people who've been claiming that they care about the debt actually do. When the trade-off is, you know, tax cuts. And I don't think we know the answer to that. I mean, I think that that probably they don't care as much as they've said that it was a good talking point when they didn't like what was being proposed. And now when they do like what's being proposed, you know, then it's not as important. And, you know, that's, you can sort of laugh at that, but it actually makes some sense, too. Like, you know, I personally would be willing to have higher deficits for policies that I think would, you know, help in the future, would invest in kids, would invest, you know, if you really believe that tax cuts are going to spur economic growth, even though, you know, maybe the official scores don't say it, you know, it's not that hard to say, well, you know, I don't want to increase a deficit on things that are not useful, that are not helpful, but are things that are helpful, then it's worth it. So I think it's not hard to see people make that adjustment. And, you know, that's what you were hearing last week, you know, from the Treasury Secretary, which is that these tax cuts would pay for themselves. So they're not saying, oh, we don't care about it, but we're saying, you know, really it's going to just get so much growth that these things will pay for themselves. So, I mean, and the other thing I think is that we've seen this huge increase in the debt. We've seen this huge reduction in interest rates. and projections that interest rates are going to remain low. That in itself, I think, has changed many people's view of how high we can go without, you know, we would have said, oh, with debt this high, you'd expect really high interest rates, and we have the opposite. So I think that's another factor that has changed the conversation as well. I think if you had seen interest rates start to get really high, I think then there would be a lot more on both sides saying we need to get together and do something to lower deficits.
Yeah, I think following up on that point, with interest rates low, there is not a constituency that cares about the deficit meaningfully, right? I think whoever is out of power cares about the deficit because they oppose whatever spending or tax version expenditure you want to put in place, but there's not actually a large community of Americans who care deeply about our deficit, I think, at least certainly not as a primary issue.
In this building, that's the
and
one down the street.
Every single one of them is in this room right now, which gives you a sense of their political power as a voting bloc. But yeah, I mean, the other piece on that, of course, is that we saw in the early 2000s a Republican willingness to go with a plan that was just going to sunset in 10 years, right? So I think that legislators right now, if they're going to their most recent recollection of what did major tax change look like, it's not, you know, the Reagan reforms at all. That's quite a long time ago, first of all, but it's the Bush tax cuts, right? And so I think that that's probably the model most people are operating with when they're thinking about what tax changes can be or should be.
Just have a couple thoughts on that. I mean, in way how we've changed since like 2010 to the political situation around fiscal policy. I do think part of it also was Obama came through on his promise not to raise taxes on the middle class, right? So the distance between the two parties on these issues for the average American, I think, actually feels less than it used to, and you know, on entitlement reform, they used to be very clearly differentiated, and now with Trump having done what he did in 2016, it's again just kind of, I find it very confusing, sort of, is there a future for entitlement reform at all? Well, right now it doesn't really look that way, so something would have to change, and probably, yeah, it would probably have to be interest rates going way up, that, like in the 1980s, that then create a coalition for really chopping deficits.
And that, if I can just jump in on one more time, I think that's such a brilliant point. The other thing that occurred to me is if you're talking about doing something that addresses the issue of the deficit, is it makes the winners and losers so much more obvious, right? So you it makes health or tax reform look more like healthcare reform did, where, okay, you're going to have these people getting these benefits, and these people know they're going to lose something, right? And so I think that's one of the real challenges of it. We're in a system right now where having there be any obvious losers, there's not a lot of trust in the system or trust that next time around we'll fix for other people what's going on. There's this very zero-sum game approach, and I think you're seeing that on entitlements too.
Since you mentioned healthcare, there's been this debate about whether the failure of healthcare reform, unless it rises again this week, how that affects the tax debate. And there's sort of an argument that it makes it significantly more difficult because they didn't repeal the Obamacare taxes as part of that, and if they want to do so, now they have to do it as part of a tax reform package. I've also seen arguments on the other side saying you could just not repeal the Obamacare taxes. How do you see the failure of healthcare playing out in the tax debate? Louise, do you want to?
Yeah, so I think that, you know, people who said it makes it hard is because you had some revenue there. I mean, you had space, right? Yeah. Which is that you were going to cut Medicaid, right? And some other benefits, but mostly cut Medicaid, the growth of Medicaid over time, and that gave you money that you could then use to pay for these repeal of the higher income investment taxes in Obamacare. So that's probably kind of off the table. So the question is, so of course it makes it harder to get a very big tax cut, right? You can't use that money, and so to the extent there's any kind of limit on how much you want to increase the deficit, that's going to make it smaller. I think politically, I think I said before, it almost makes it more likely that they'll get some kind of tax cut just because they lost so, you know, obviously on a major campaign promise that I think they need something. And that might make them more likely to find something that they can all agree on. But that's a political argument. And, you know, I'm an economist, so what do I know?
Yeah, I mean, I think that you can imagine the politics of it cutting both ways. On the one hand, there might be a little more interest, politically speaking, in finding something we can all agree on so that we get something done. On the other hand, people might feel that well, our leadership couldn't get it together on the thing that they'd been saying they were going to do for 7 years, so I got to watch out for me, and I'm not doing much for the party right now. And you could see it going either way, right? But I think that it's certainly not the position that if I, you know, were in Congress, this is not the position I'd want my party to be in when I'm trying to make these judgments at all.
Curious to whether any of you see the likelihood of a policy change that moves truly in sort of this more populist direction that we heard on the campaign. Are there any policies you would point to as likely to be put in place that move in that direction?
Well, I do think that the president really does seem to care about this American jobs thing, right? A lot of his personal attention seems to have been devoted to that in these early months. And so I think the question to ask about that is whether it will amount to a big systematic policy with far-reaching consequences, or whether it just tends to be a lot of photo opportunities sort of lined up in a way that allows you to sort of craft a populist rhetoric without necessarily having shifted the fundamentals. So I think right now the latter of those two possibilities seems much more likely to me, but we'll see. There is always the question of if the president started really shopping for Democratic allies, and putting together a more populist coalition across parties, you know, that sounds hard to fathom in the current moment. But on November 9th, I thought it was not such a crazy thing to think about. I think that possibility remains out there. If he feels like he's just totally spinning his wheels trying to work with an increasingly internally divided Republican coalition, maybe he'll try to sort of go in a completely new direction.
So I think the health reform debate makes it harder because, you know, Trump showed that he was willing to go against his campaign promises, do things that would hurt his constituencies in terms of raising their premiums, you know, not ensuring that health care, cutting Medicaid. And I think that makes him, first of all, a very untrustworthy, I mean, apart from everything else, a very untrustworthy partner for a Democrat to go and decide to go against their party right now and sort of go to this populist, you know, proposal where, you know, I think he's shown that that's just not that important to him fundamentally. And so I think that that's unlikely. But, you know, you never know.
Yeah, I think I basically agree. I think there's likely to be things kind of like the carrier deal, you know, where it's got some photo opportunities attached to it. It has a negligible impact systemically speaking, and it works via a large amount of money going to business owners. I think those are elements of that I'd expect to see again.
Vanessa,
infrastructure is the big one, you know, that is worth tossing out as the one that people were most eagerly expecting could sort of do something with big consequences for American jobs, could have a real populist emphasis on it. I mean, you know, I think there were some of us who thought that could be priority number one in reshuffling American politics. Today it's kind of nowhere to be seen, but we'll keep looking out for it.
Vanessa, one of the implications from some of your research, though, has been that loopholes in particular are sort of very high salience to people. People are aware of those in a way that maybe they don't understand marginal tax rates and sort of the tax system more generally. Mm-hmm. And so I wonder about a tax reform that, by repealing a couple of specific sort of unpopular loopholes, is then able to be sold in a way as being populist, even if sort of all of us who are sitting here sort of pointing to the models say that it's not.
Right. I mean, I think that there is this sort of fundamental challenge in terms of people being able to assess tax reform as it's happening, because there's such an interest in, among politicians to present their plans in the best possible light, and the media people receive on these issues is so polarized, I think it's very hard for people to actually get accurate information. There's some good research on the Bush-era tax cuts suggesting that people really had fundamentally misunderstood a lot of those policies. I think you're absolutely right that it's likely that closing a few loopholes, drawing attention to a few loopholes, could become sort of the major story that overrides the sort of systemic application or implications of a tax package. But I think, you know, fundamentally there's this huge gap between what public opinion would suggest would be the popular policies and what policies actually get implemented, right? And that's not just true in tax reform, that's true across the board. You were mentioning infrastructure. By far, this is a bipartisanly popular thing with Americans. Americans believe we should be investing in roads and schools and things like that, and bridges and sort of rebuilding our infrastructure. This is something that you get overwhelming, almost consensus-level support for in the American public. And at the same time, if you ask, like, what bothers people most about taxes, their top two concerns are that corporations and the wealthy aren't paying their share. Right. So if you were to look at public opinion and guess blindly, naively, what our policies were going to look like, you'd imagine a very, very different political moment from the one we're in. Right. So I think that, I think it's crucially important to understand what most people think. I do not think it is the best guide to, unfortunately, to guessing what legislators will do.
I'd actually love to unpack that slightly, and I'd love to get all three of you to weigh in on this quickly. This is selfish on one level because I write about this for the public, but I suspect a lot of people here in one form or another communicate these ideas to the public. If there's a lot of, if some of your findings are that sort of facts do affect people's opinions on this, how do we do a better job of talking about these issues to a public that is understandably not going to sit here and delve into distribution tables in any kind of deep way?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a critically important question for, you know, trying to build, if we're talking about building a political system that does not just have this huge uncertainty and polarization, it has to, you know, you have to be able to talk to most people. And the problem is that most people don't, well, the real problem is that most people don't receive their news from Brookings, or they would be getting it right, you know what I mean? But people have sort of self-selected into media that really reinforce what they think. So it's very, very hard to break through the kind of echo chambers that people exist in. When it comes to giving people policy information. Now, I think in some places you can really make a difference. One thing that I've found is that talking to people about taxes paid by low-income people, which tend to be forgotten, so things like sales taxes and payroll taxes, which are very expensive for low-income and working people, when people are reminded of those taxes that people, that lower-income people pay, they're much more supportive of government spending on lower-income and working families, right? Because they see those people as chipping in a way that they've kind of forgotten when we all focus on the top end of the federal income tax, right? So I think there are places for that, but then there are also places where facts, you know, kind of bounce off, right? And unfortunately, one of those places tends to be, for instance, attitudes about immigration and immigrants, right? So that it's widely believed that immigrants don't pay taxes and undocumented immigrants aren't doing their share. And of course, actually, undocumented immigrants are propping up Social Security and Medicare because they're paying in money that they don't currently have the right to receive, right? So I think that on some issues you can make headway, but sometimes you're hitting up against sort of symbolic attitudes and very deeply held stereotypes, and that I think that's a place where just bringing some facts and a pie chart to the table are not going to get the job done, unfortunately.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, you have a hard job, right? Because there's a lot of research recently, you're reading about it, how the facts can backfire, yeah. Right? That just keep on explaining how people are wrong and that they're not thinking about something right just hardens their position, you know? And I think what Vanessa said, though, I think is to the extent, people say, how do you communicate? If you can tell a story, right, you can personalize, humanize, that is a way of getting through where people aren't going through, trying to do the math because you're not going to win on that. But people are just feeling, some kind of kinship, right? And that I think has the possibility. But I think it's a hugely difficult problem, especially with the polarization of the media sources. So, but what will be interesting is to see if there is a tax plan that starts to come out is how, Fox News will talk about it. And I don't know what the answer to that will be, right? And I think that will matter.
We have some time for questions from the audience. I think there are folks with microphones walking around. Let's start here in the front.
Yes, good morning. Thank you very much. We have a president who, as a candidate, when asked about releasing his tax returns and the prospect that he paid no taxes, was said paying taxes is for losers, and he was proud of it. So although your work, Ms. Williamson, suggested that there's a civic responsibility that Americans have, in fact, our president is the poster child for not feeling that sense of civic responsibility. So even with that, and I'm getting into a question, even though something like 55% of the people say they'd like to see his tax returns, it appears to be mostly like purient interest, because 95% of the people who voted for him say they will vote for him again, and 15% of the people who voted for Hillary Clinton say they wouldn't vote for her again. So my question is it acceptable that the rich actually don't pay taxes, because that's actually what he stands for? So don't you all have to flip the coin and accept the fact that people will, in fact, support rich people not paying the taxes?
Vanessa, let's start with you. I'm interested in one piece of that especially, right, which is this sort of faith in the American tax system if we sort of we now have a president who was able to game the system to some degree, and also, of course, where we don't have many details on it.
He supported it. He was
gaming the system. So I think that there are a couple interesting things here. First of all, it's important to recognize that that rhetoric from Donald Trump is genuinely quite different from the traditional Republican rhetoric, Republican elite rhetoric about taxes. Yes, certainly it's been the standing position of the Republican Party that taxes should go down and that taxes are sort of bad, and holding an anti-tax position is the position to hold to be a Republican. Yes, that was always different from demonstrating that you'd paid your own taxes. And you can remember, just looking back to Mitt Romney, who made a very big point, he'd always paid 13%, at least 13%. And that was what he said over and over again as he was, his tax returns were coming out or had just come out. Anyway, the point he wanted to make was that he had at least paid this much, and that was what he stood on. So it's actually a really striking change, and sort of demonstrates one of the ways in which Trump's public rhetoric really does differ from the Republican standard position. So I'm interested to see. So the American consensus that paying your taxes is a civic duty is something that has held steady for 40 years. Polls on taxes tend to be done in April, which means that those polls are just coming out now. And I'm very interested to see whether you see a switch on the Republican side. It has traditionally been the case that Republicans are more likely than Democrats to describe taxpaying as a moral obligation. It would be interesting to see whether that changes this year. But, you know, the level of public commitment to that has been so very high. I mean, we're talking 80 or 90% agreement that even if there is a partisan divide, I'd expect it's relatively small. On the sort of politics of it, I had expected that one of the sort of unifying phrases that Democrats would use to simply oppose tax reform from the Republicans, whole stop, was this question of whether any tax reform would benefit the Trump administration, right? And I think we've begun to see some of that rhetoric coming out of Schumer's office. So I think that it does actually make for a slightly different set of political dynamics, this particular question.
So I see it a bit differently than the questioner's framing does. I see this as sort of part of the cult of the entrepreneur that Donald Trump has promoted about himself, to say that I'm not just a normal person, I'm a dynamic business person of the kind that really makes the economy go. And his position was not that taxes are for losers, but that his own dynamic efforts were so complicated and generated so many things that he was able to legally not pay taxes. He certainly never portrayed himself as a tax evader who had somehow broken the law. But he had of course served his own interests as this dynamic businessman, because he assumes that you, like him, believe that such entrepreneurs really are what make America great and need to be given free rein. So I think, you know, that is something the Republicans have. I think that's been a part of the Republican mindset for a while. I agree with Trump. That's all the focus and sort of normal patriotic duty of regular people to pay taxes doesn't get any recognition at all. But I do see it as something that, you know, and I think the American electorate who put Trump in the White House obviously just accepted his view of himself to some, at least enough to vote him into office. So I think it doesn't necessarily mean that they've totally shifted their views on what's normal conduct for your normal average Joe.
Another question here?
In the back here. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. I was wondering if y'all could talk about the future for financial regulations, particularly given the difficulty pinning down costs when doing traditional benefit cost analyses on them, as well as the recent guidelines on the two-for-one rule, focusing on costs as the major indicator, and the administration's kind of just general attitude towards financial regulations. Thank you.
Bill? So, I mean, obviously Dodd-Frank is a big target. The Republican rhetoric on Dodd-Frank has always been it's 100% bad, which, given it's such a complex law with so many moving parts, has always been a little confusing to me. I don't think there's a lot of potential for actual full whole-scale Dodd-Frank repeal, but I do think there's a lot of sections of it that look vulnerable and that you could possibly count up to 60 votes on. You know, giving regulatory relief to community banks would certainly be one of those. Maybe the Volcker Rule would be another. So there are areas where I think some kind of legislative change is likely. In terms of your other question about two-for-one, I think it gets right at the point. I don't think it's actually so unique to financial regulation. I mean, in a lot of areas of regulation, understanding exactly what the costs and benefits of a rule in place are, it's very difficult. The guidance that the White House has put out to this point says that you should not just use cost-benefit analyses made at the time of promulgation of the rule. So it's really a big looming question of how the OMB would go about doing these cost exercises. I don't have answers yet. So that's one of the big question marks on that policy.
Back here.
Thank you. I'm Jordan Seltz. I'm a student at Howard University, and my question is exactly about taxation without representation. So there's a campaign that was started, Occupy Wall Street or whatever. In previous administrations, they've had to deal with that same campaign. How is that going to play into this current administration?
I don't think that it's likely to be more successful in this administration than in previous. I think it's less likely to be something that people care about. Dan, D.C. is a Democratic district, so I don't see much action on that there.
Yeah, I think that I think there is a lot of public concern about Wall Street and about the sort of power of the wealthy over our political system. And I think there's more of that now in this current administration. I think we've seen a real striking uptick in sort of popular mobilization on the left. I think the question looking forward is whether that energy gets channeled into, for instance, electoral success or other forms of organizing that have sustainability. And I think that is an open question. I don't think it's at all resolved yet. But I think one of the important, perhaps the most obvious takeaway from the last election is having more people on your side does not mean that you win, right? And when it comes to political mobilization, that's absolutely the case, right? So I think that one of the most interesting things that, as a political scientist, I'm interested in watching over the next 4 years is whether very widespread and initial response to the Trump administration in terms of popular opposition becomes a sustainable movement that actually results in political power.
Hi, I'm Laura Sarikoski, a reporter from a Finnish newspaper, Helsingin Sanomat. I have a more general question about the future of the United States. I've been traveling to 48 states now and talking to people from all political sides, and I'm really worried about the future of the United States. That is, I'm wondering whether there exists anymore any kind of a discussion or dialogue between, for example, you and your more conservative colleagues. Because, I go to these events and I listen to the Democratic side, I listen to the Republican side, and both sort of talk only to each other. And now when Trump is in the White House and he's not a traditional conservative, I was wondering if there would be more room maybe for some kind of a dialogue between, let's put it this way, the establishment or the elite of both parties and the think tanks, because you could actually reach a little bit more of a common ground, since the president is not only from another party. How do you see the sort of the future of the political debate on tax issue, but also on other political issues in the U.S.?
I mean, I'm not sure that we don't talk to other people. In fact, you know, Kevin Hassett has just been named the head of the Council of Economic Advisors. He works next door, and we talk to Kevin all the time. And, you know, I used to work with Kevin at the Fed. So I think among sort of the, you know, among economists and stuff, you know, there is debate. But you know, as we said, the kind of conversations that we have are really very different from the conversations that are in the political sphere. You know, we talk about whether or not the exchange rate is going to adjust to the border. You know, we talk about technical stuff, and of course, we have no problem talking to you that way. So I think you get back to this question that we had before, which is, you know, how do our discussions matter for the politics? You know, is there a way that common ground that economists might have or political scientists might have can somehow translate into common ground, you know, among voters? And, you know, I think we're all kind of stymied on that question, frankly. It's very hard to know when the kind of discussions we have don't seem to matter for voters.
And on that note of certitude and optimism, we will end things. We're out of time. Thank you all so much for being here, and thank you to our panel.
Thank you.
Good morning. How are you?
Ready.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Hey, Claude. John? I've always said who, not Hugh, right? Okay.
As in, who dad?
Who dad?
Yeah, look, I looked over the entire list.
Thank you. Yeah. Oh, Jim is here.
European correspondent.
You ready to? Hi. Can you guys all hear me? I'm Karen Tumulty, and I cover politics at the Washington Post. And for those of you who have not been following Twitter while you've been sitting in here, the President of the United States just said he plans to have a man on Mars by the end of his presidency, preferably in the first term.
He might want to talk to some scientists.
There is no word yet on how he's going to get the Martians to pay for it. So... Well, it's probably a joke on his part, but he did say that. So anyway, I just want to make sure everybody's up to speed on the news. Anyway, thank you so much for being here. We have a terrific panel here to talk about the question of public management in the first 100 days of this administration and beyond. In my immediate left, we have Elaine Kmark, whose current job is as the founding director of the Center for Effective Public Management here. But Elaine, along with Bill Galston, was one of the founders of the New Democratic Movement back when it was new. And also oversaw reinventing government, that big project for Al Gore. to her left is Bill Galston, who is a senior fellow in governance studies here. And I say stories.
Government stories.
You had it right the first time.
That's a Freudian slip on my part, because so often I will call up
Remember
Bill.
That.
But I will call him up and say, I've got this half-formed idea for a story. Where's it taking me? And then to his left, we have Nicole Turner Lee, a fellow at the Center for Technology Innovation in Governance Studies. She is also a specialist who has done a lot of research on the question of technology issues and how they affect African Americans and other people of color. And then all the way to the left, we have John Hudak, the deputy director of the Center for Effective Public Management here. And we are probably not going to have any time to discuss his latest book, Marijuana, A Short History. But the first question I think and we will have time at the end for questions from all of you. But the first question I'd like to put to all of you is we're coming to the end of this first 100 days on the brink of a government shutdown. What does that tell you is the takeaway from these 100 days, and what does that suggest about the second 100 days?
I'll say very briefly, this has been amateur hour at the White House. We have elected the least experienced person ever to hold the office of the presidency. I looked at this from presidents from 1900 on, and the average years of experience before becoming a president or a major party nominee has been 12, and the median has been 12. This is the first person we have ever elected who has 0 years of public sector experience. Now, if you think about professional sports teams, when the Redskins hire a coach, right, they look for somebody who played football. When you go to a neurosurgeon, you look for someone who is board certified. When a university hires somebody to teach, they look for someone who has publications that have been peer reviewed. Politics is the only area where suddenly in the 21st century, no experience is required. We used to actually require experience in politics, and that was because we had a different nominating system. This is the first time, however, that we have actually, the nominating system has yielded someone with no experience in government. So even if you are sympathetic to many of Donald Trump's objectives, public policy objectives, you have to look at this first 100 days and say he doesn't know what he's doing. And therefore, the possibility that he will actually fulfill his campaign promises is pretty low.
Well, as they say sometimes, in the Congress, I associate myself with my colleague's prior remarks.
You'd better.
Yeah, I have 30 years of experience associating myself with your remarks. but two additional points. Point number one, is that the prospect of a government shutdown, I think, reflects the difficulty that the president is having integrating the views of his base and his and of himself on the one hand with the views of his congressional Republican majority and the majority of the American people. His base wants the wall. The majority of the American people do not want the wall. Enthusiasm among Republicans in Congress for the wall is minimal. And so he's trying to insert a minority agenda into a majority party, and it's not working very well. Here's the second point. The art of the deal presupposes that everything is negotiable. It's a matter of more or less. But not all political disputes are of that character. And we've already seen him flummox during the healthcare negotiations by the intransigence of the Freedom Caucus in the face of an offer that anybody on the other side of a real estate deal would have accepted. And similarly, in the case of the government shutdown, the president had what he thought must have been a splendid idea, that he would offer to fund on a dollar-for-dollar basis the insurance security fund for Obamacare in return for that funding for the wall. And guess what? Not a single Democrat is willing to take him up on that because they're not convertible currencies. For Democrats, it's a total non-starter, no deal. So what does Mr. Art of the Deal do when he's confronted with the politics of no deal?
But Nicole, it's also true that he has, and probably uniquely among presidents, has not had a honeymoon, in part because his base is still with him. It looks like there's nothing that can move them off of their support for him, but he doesn't seem to have made any inroads in people who didn't support him.
Yeah, that's the interesting thing about him. I mean, I echo my colleagues in terms of their sentiments, so I want to put that on record that I do agree with that. Without saying it again and again and again, right? But I think you're right. I think part of the poll that just recently came out about his approval rating suggests that he's got this low approval rating among everybody, but the oxymoron is the people who voted for him still think he's a strong leader. And so it makes you sit back and wonder, what is actually going on here in this 100 days, and is the confusion actually real? And what I find to be interesting on the government shutdown, Chuck Schumer tweeted out this morning, we could actually get a deal done if he wasn't in the room, which is very different than what we've heard over the past in terms of the partisanship between, you know, the shutdown under Obama was usually a partisanship issue. Here, they're like, if you go away, we'll actually work together. And that's actually really scary, right? Because you've got 100 days where there's sort of been this put every post-it note up there, this push this minority agenda, stay with my base, so when he's not necessarily, you know, messing and mucking up government, he's out in the streets appealing back to the base. But yet at the same time, you feel a majority of people in this country just feel, you know, discredited and alienated from the political process, which I think is interesting because if you look at how most people feel who have been disenfranchised here, the first 100 days indicate the type of chaos and turmoil we will be in civil society if we continue down this pathway. The same token, if you spin it a little differently, I think what the first 100 days has also taught us, that people have conviction about what they care about. This is a president, since inauguration, has had a protest happen every week. And so we're beginning to see people who had concerns that were not necessarily played out the ballot box, coming to the street post-inauguration, during the presidency, trying to put their word out. Again, the question becomes, will we be heard? And I think that's where this whole mismanagement of governance, this institutional decline, and this new normalcy is really confusing.
Over to you, John.
Right, right. But John, amateur hour, it's not that people, that, I mean, it turned out that expertise and experience was actually something voters seemed to be running away from.
Voters were running away from experience. They had a choice between, as Elaine said, the least experienced candidate to run for president in the 20th or 21st century up against someone with a lot of experience. Whether you liked Hillary Clinton's performance as first lady, as senator, as secretary of state, it was a resume that was quite long. So yeah, obviously voters ran away from that kind of experience. The problem is getting elected and governing are two very different things. And so the least experienced president in American history came to office and surrounded himself by people who lacked experience in federal public management, federal policymaking, federal lawmaking. And so that creates a perfect storm for Mr. Trump. His lack of experience, I would argue, is not a recipe for automatic failure. But when you put yourself in a mix of individuals who don't complement the weaknesses that you have, then you get the situation that you have. Rents Priebus, the chief of staff, is seen as this Washington insider. He came to town 6 years ago. He never ran the Republican Party when it had total control of government. He oversaw a party that had no requirement to govern. This idea that he is this party insider who's the adult in the room is foolish. He lacks experience as much as Jared Kushner does, as much as Ivanka Trump does, as much as a lot of the people in that White House do. The best thing that the president could do is have an apprentice episode in the White House and just start firing people and bringing in those insiders that don't have to be in front of cameras every day, who don't need to be the public image that those voters who despise that kind of insiderness, what he needs is to bring those people in, get things done behind the scenes, shake him when he needs to be shaken, and tell him no when he needs to be told no, and then let the function of government continue. Until he does that, this is going to be a repeat cycle for him.
But, okay, so you guys have been around for the first 100 days of an administration, and you know, I think that nobody thought Bill Clinton's first 100 days were such a, no. a great example of success either. And it, you know, it set the pace for a really disastrous midterm election. Ultimately, though, I think people think Bill Clinton did learn. Could you talk a little bit about the learning curve and whether you're seeing any sign that there is such a thing going on now?
That's really a good question, and I've been amused to watch you guys in the press go through several iterations of trying to explain Donald Trump, right? And to your credit, you've given him the benefit of a doubt, right? You've said, oh, well, these tweets, at first everybody was saying, the tweets are designed, they're really part of a strategy to draw attention away from X that's going wrong. And that's, and isn't that smart, right? And that was sort of explanation number one. And then people kind of dropped it. Because what Donald Trump, and I want to say this, presidents get the staffs that they want, right? And they tend to find staff members that don't contradict them, that reinforce them. And Donald Trump is really not a person who learns, okay? He's got severe narcissistic qualities. There is no indication that he's interested in learning. Everything we know about him is that his news source is cable television, and you've been on it, and I've been on it, we've all been on it, so we like cable television, but come on, you know, it isn't exactly a briefing book. There isn't much indication that he can learn or wants to learn. And I think that's what makes him different from Bill Clinton. God knows Bill Clinton's first 100 days were no great shakes, right? But Clinton was constantly learning. And Clinton came in with expertise in some areas. And that would be my final point. Most modern presidents, they don't know the whole job. Nobody does. But they come in knowing something. George Bush was really new education policy. Bill Clinton, Bill and I can attest to this. Boy, you went in with fear if you tried to brief Bill Clinton on Medicaid or welfare policy, because he always knew more than you did. To come in knowing nothing, is a really big, big problem. And it creates a learning curve that's overwhelming. And if you add to that a personality that's used to sort of flying by the seat of his pants and using his instincts, this is a disaster. I don't think he has shown any ability to learn.
What do you guys think? Any signs of
Well, a couple of things. First of all, there is a huge distinction between the domestic policy team and the foreign policy team. And the foreign policy team is functioning reasonably well. You know, the united voice of that team has gotten the president to walk back a number of his more extreme statements, and American foreign policy is now within hailing distance, for the most part, of where it has been traditionally. So in that respect, an important piece of learning took place when General Flynn was fired and replaced by General McMaster. And I guess a takeaway from that episode is that you can lie to the country, but don't dare lie to the vice president. So that's point number one. Point number two is that it is very difficult for presidents to avoid early stumbles. Presidents who avoid early stumbles are the exception and not the rule. I am plenty old enough to remember the Bay of Pigs, which occurred in JFK's first 100 days. And that wasn't a political catastrophe. That was a catastrophe on every front. Lots of people died. Lots of people ended up in prison for years. America's credibility throughout the hemisphere was severely impaired on both the right, which accused him of insufficiently backing the Cuban exiles, and on the left, which rightly accused him of having gone along with a plot to overthrow a government. But JFK, a young man, learned from that experience. Bill Clinton, also a young man, learned from his early stumbles. And I think in many respects, Jimmy Carter, who got off to a very bad start, learned through experience, for example, that if you try to send everything to Congress and expect them to get it done all at once, you'll end up getting nothing done. Carter didn't have a lot of national political experience, to put it mildly, but he was not, you know, despite some rigidities of personality, he was not incapable of learning. I can think of three presidents in the 20th century who've gotten off to a really good start. Well, maybe four. Wilson did. FDR did, Reagan did, and Obama did, mm-hmm. Right? As a matter of fact, I would say that Obama's first 6 months were his finest hour on many, many fronts, and it wasn't uphill from there. In many respects, it was downhill from there. But one, I think, should be cautious about drawing a straight line from the data points, day one of Trump, day 100 of Trump, all the way down to the bottom, because in the last analysis, I think that Trump's desire to be a winner may, in fact, overcome all of his other instincts. And we shall see. There's going to be a tussle between most of his instincts on the one hand and his desire to be regarded as a winner on the other.
But President Obama, among others, started with a really cohesive team. Mm-hmm. And having covered that White House, you know, the amount of leaking, the amount of discipline was extraordinary. You not only have a lot of tension that is spilling out into the public view in this White House, but you look at the agencies, and a lot of the sort of second and third tier jobs are empty, and the bureaucracy, the you know, source of a lot of the expertise has been labeled the deep state. Mm-hmm. So where does this take us?
I mean, I was going to say, and I'll just say with the agencies, one of the challenges that we're experiencing now is, even though you have the executive office, particularly in the area that I work of media and telecom, you've always had some level of independence when it comes to the regulatory front. But it appears what we're seeing across the board, which we, I think many of us in this room estimated would just happen at the executive office, is this repeal and not replace mentality that's sort of gone into every agency across the board, which is somewhat challenging for many of us who expected, despite his lack of experience, that there would be people in the cabinets, you know, secretaries of agencies and others that would still try to develop an autonomous agenda, We're not seeing that, right? What we're actually seeing is a build from the type of atmosphere that's actually been created, the political atmosphere, and we're seeing the partisanship actually push into some of the agencies. And it's been one of those areas, like you said, where, you know, I would say that there's a part reservation of people who want to actually go work for the administration just simply because expertise is not necessarily valued. It's more of, you know, your ability to be a yes person to the administration. I think in this administration what's also different is, you know, just as we sit up on this panel today, there's a president who accidentally Trump actively tweets and he calls out people. So you also have people who know going into those positions has some level of repercussion if you're not necessarily, you know, on the right side. And that was evidence of what we saw for the first time in the administration where the shakeup up until, you know, just a couple of weeks ago where rumors of Bannon and other people leaving were public knowledge. I don't remember Obama, you know, us ever actually thinking like that. I mean, the Obama administration, like you said, the discipline in terms of communication, the discipline in terms of filling those positions, the discipline in bringing experts, you know, from academia, industry, civil society together to think through who those positions are, the discipline of educating. You know, there were points when President Obama came into office and said, I don't know some of this stuff. Let me bring in some of the smartest people who do. And as we look at his administration over 8 years, there was turnover, but not like this. You know, there weren't stories in the press about problems that were almost like National Enquirer stories, right, coming out of the administration. And I think that's what most of us are sort of mourning, this level of discipline when it comes to the administration. We don't want to read the tweets. And if I can, just real quickly, with the Twitter piece, I think most of us had this promise after the joint sessions that we found a president, right? The tweets, the media was like, he was on script. He's going to stay there. And, you know, less than 48 hours of work that I do, the tweet was about something totally erroneous and not related to the speech. And so when you have that type of lack of discipline and no one can stop you, I don't know where you land up.
Well, Karen, I think your question touches on the biggest issue in terms of the president not learning from what is going on or learning from history. The president has come to office, and a lot of people argue that he is looking to dismantle 8 years of the Obama legacy. It's actually not right. He's looking to dismantle about a half a century of public policy in the United States. There is not much that the Bush administration did that the Trump base is going to be very pleased about. There's not much that Clinton did that the Trump base is going to be pleased about. The promises that he has made during the campaign trail represent such a seismic shift in American public policy that the only way to get it done is to have a remarkable legislative team in the White House, which he clearly lacks, and at least by output he lacks, and B, to staff up the agencies as quickly and as powerfully as possible. The number of vacancies across government is malpractice. Not malpractice generally, malpractice to his own supporters. Right. He is not positioning the executive branch of government to do anything to meet the challenges that lay before him. And his supporters should be furious with this. I think the president came to office, that lack of experience and the lack of experience around him created a situation in which he didn't fully understand the size of the appointed executive branch and the power of the appointees and how critical they are not just to doing work within agencies, but getting a president from point A to point B. And his inability to do that is not showing yet because bureaucracy is slow. But a year from now, 2 years from now, when he looks out at regulatory reform that is stumbling, looking at base public policy, whether it's with immigration, whether it's with defense, whether it's in the State Department, he is going to ask himself, why haven't we done better? Likely he'll ask, why haven't you done better to Rex Tillerson or Jim Mattis or whomever? And the answer is going to rest with the president, that he has not filled the vast majority of appointments. Now, granted, a president gets to make about 4,000 appointments. We can't expect all 4,000 to be filled in the first 100 days. But when you have cabinet members without deputies, when you have entire slates of undersecretaries and depsecs who are vacant, when you have a State Department that doesn't have a spokesperson, that is unacceptable. That is behavior that is not only inexperienced, but someone who is clearly not listening
to the cabinet secretaries, to outside advisors, to the vice president, who has to understand from his own experience, both as a governor and as a member of Congress, the importance of these people being put into place. That is what is going to hold up the president's agenda. As I said, that and not having a legislative team in place that, frankly, has to work with a Speaker of the House who is wildly ineffective and overrated at what he is put to task to do. And
Tell us what you really think, John.
in the absence of a failed speakership, presidential leadership has to fill that void. Right now, we have a failed speaker and a failed president, and the Republican Party should be smashing their heads against the wall every day, asking themselves how they've gotten themselves into this place and how the hell you get out of it.
Well, that goes back to Bill's point, right? The real question here is, will something right the ship? Okay? I mean, I think this is what you put out there. Will there be a moment, whether it's the midterm elections or something else, where Donald Trump says, whoa, this is not working. Mm-hmm. I need to change what I've been doing. And, you know, my gut says there's a personality problem to doing that. Bill points out that there's the opposite personnel. I mean, he is a winner. He loves winning. Maybe that will have him sort of wake up and say, oh, yeah, I got to change what I'm doing. That's the great unknown here, right?
But wait a minute. He declares everything a victory, right. Whether
it's yeah.
a victory or not.
That's the most effective.
You know, the question is whether when he declares victory, the American people will believe him. And over time, I think presidential declarations of great leaps forward will tend to be devalued more and more if they don't correspond to the experience on the ground, at the grassroots level. I mean, there's a great scene in a Marx Brothers picture where this is the kind of Marxism I instinctively gravitate towards, where, you know, sorry, Xinhua. where, you know, Chico's caught in bed with another guy's wife, and Chico pulls up the sheet, denies it. The guy gets angrier and angrier, and he finally says, how can you deny it? I'm looking right at you. To which Chico responds famously, well, who are you going to believe, me or your own eyes? Now, at some point, that gets to be the question for a presidency. If the president's understanding of what's going on becomes radically disconnected from what's actually going on.
But can I say there, I believe in this administration that there are people who feel that he's been effective for them. I mean, the movement towards less regulation has actually satiated the desires and needs of people that did not necessarily mm-hmm. vote for him, but they're all riding that ship that they believe has actually begun to go the right way, even though it's at the detriment of the people. And so I think, you know, part of the challenge that we have is we're seeing a society where different portions of the population are getting what they need. The challenge is there's a huge proportion of people who are sort of the innocent bystanders of whatever's going to happen in his policies about climate change. You know, all of that is just going to be us coming back to visit that. But I've been in many conversations where there are people who are completely happy with the way things are going because of the fact that the marketplace is
shifting. But if they're so happy, why is the share of the American people who think he's doing a good job substantially lower than the already small minority of the American people who voted for him? In other words, he's not expanding from his base. He's shrinking his base.
I agree with Bill that the long-term prospects of this we won on everything has a real detriment to the office of the presidency.
Right.
It certainly does. I think in the short term, though, one of the most effective things this president has done in 100 days is selling executive action to a group of people who are eating it up. Now, I take your point, Bill, that his numbers are tanking, mostly with independents right now. But the people who he feels he needs to speak to, his base, believe everything that he says, or almost everything that he says. And that short-termism for the president will become a medium-term and longer-term problem when, like you said, eventually the bottom falls out. This is a minority president. This is someone who was elected with about 45% of the vote in a 60% turnout election. he has convinced himself, and I honestly believe that he thinks this, that he did win by the largest margin in the 20th century, that he has tremendous support, that there were 5 million illegals who voted for Clinton.
Well, he tweeted yesterday that the polls show that he once again would win the popular vote. Right.
Yeah, I think he truly believes this. Poll. I don't think this is true.
And by the way, your own publication provided some evidence for that proposition.
So the point is, he's speaking to a group of people in this echo chamber, and that, you know, plant your flag in the sand approach works for them, so it works for him. He's not thinking about moderates. He's not thinking about independents. He's not thinking about moderate Democrats. He's thinking about his narrow base of, let's say, 25% to 30% of the American electorate. And when he's consuming news that largely comes from that base or speaks to that base, it is just constantly telling him that he's doing the right thing and that these grand statements are the way forward, even in the face of victory or middling success.
Mm-hmm. Well, I really do want to get to what is on your mind as well. So if anybody has any questions, where's the microphone? Why don't we work from the back forward, right there, this gentleman.
Hi, I'm Richard Skinner with the NYU Washington Center. My standard line about Trump so far is he's turning out to be a surprisingly conventional Republican president who's just really, really bad at his job. And, you know, during the campaign, Trump was famously kind of all over the map on a lot of issues. Sometimes he sounded like a foreign policy non-interventionist. Sometimes he sounded like an economic populist. Sometimes he sounded like he really didn't care that much about social issues. But instead, what we've gotten is a guy who, on most issues, to the extent that he has any coherent policy, just sounds like and is acting like a pretty conservative Republican. Immigration might be one exception, but it's not exactly shocking to see a conservative party go hard line on immigration. We're seeing that in Britain right now. So I'm wondering, why has, even as Trump's been so incompetent and unable to manage the government, is he pursuing policies that sound like a conventional Republican? That doesn't mean that they're wildly popular policies. The HCA was much more a Republican bill than a Trump bill, and it was a disaster.
So what would you say? Standard issue Republicanism?
Well, here's a way of looking at the Trump administration. By Gaul, divided into three parts. Those of you who studied Latin in high school, there is first of all the part of the Trump administration which, like the Trump campaign, entered into transactions with the established Republican Party. Okay, and so the social conservatives got a blood oath on the judiciary, which so far the president has honored. The limited government faction got a blood oath on tax cuts. And I'm convinced that at the end of the day, this administration won't deliver tax reform, but it will deliver big tax cuts, because that is core to the DNA of the Republican Party, and the president is perfectly willing to go along with that. So there is the transactional part of the Trump agenda. Then there is the distinctively Trump part of the Trump agenda, which focuses on issues like immigration, trade, and an America First perspective on foreign policy. And then there's the third part, which I think of as the Wild West, where the president doesn't have a lot of interest, and the Republican Party, except for very small interest groups, doesn't really care that much at all. And so you end up with a board-certified neurosurgeon in charge of HUD. Right?
Right, yeah.
And a fired Surgeon General.
go figure. So I would say that in those areas where candidate Trump entered into binding transactions with the existing base of the Republican Party, he has been a conventional Republican. And in those areas that are distinctively Trumpish, he has not been. So, for example, if you look at George W. Bush's policies on immigration and trade and foreign policy, they are the polar opposites of Donald Trump's policies. So I will, you know, I will give you 2 stars out of 4 for your thesis.
Yes, ma'am.
So Donald Trump may like to win, but he's used to winning by bullying and pushing his point of view. There are some people in some places where there's a potential that they won't be bullied. So there's a question to me about how he learns at 71 that bullying might not work. But my other question is one of transparency. Mm-hmm. And he's, the administration so far has been, on the one hand, very untransparent with who he calls on the phone and blah, 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 and logs. But on the other hand, he issues an order that may potentially kill hundreds or thousands of people in a foreign place over chocolate cake in a public dining room.
But a really beautiful chocolate cake.
Yes.
No, big, beautiful chocolate
but
cake.
But my point is, one, to comment on the impact that his real style in deal-making has been bullying and how that plays out. And the other is the transparency with sort of these odd boundaries where he'll do certain things in public that would have gotten Obama or a potential Clinton impeached. Mm-hmm. Those are the two.
Let me take the first point. And I think, in presidential politics, there's actually a space for bullying. I think a president who doesn't do that is a weak president. I think there would probably be a lot of Democrats in Congress who would argue that if President Obama was a little more of a bully, it probably would have helped him out a little bit. But then there is obviously an extreme. And I don't know if the president is going to see the limitations of that type of behavior. In many ways, he took a very hands-off approach to healthcare and let the House screw it up for him. And so on the CR, he has reinserted himself on the continuing resolution just over the past weekend and has blown up what was an agreement that was really taking shape. And by all accounts, he's bullying about the wall, and he's bullying about defense spending and a deal with healthcare subsidies. That is not going to work for him, period. He is not going to get all 3 of those. My guess is he's not going to get any of those in maybe additional defense spending. But I think for the president, each time that he tries this aggressive insertion of himself, oftentimes at the wrong time in the process, he's going to come up short. And either he is going to, as we said before, learn from that and start to change his behaviors, or it is going to just be this continuous cycle of overbullying instead of proper bullying, I guess you would call it.
Yeah, but if I can say, I mean, I agree with that, right? There's a certain political cadence that comes with asserting your point. I mean, I think what you're talking about, the type of bullying that we're seeing is a bullying that has larger repercussions for women, you know, for people of color, for, you know, I mean, there's this bullying that comes when a president, you know, even if you go back over presidents, George Bush and others, there was somewhat of a style that they had. If this was not an issue that they could deal with, somebody else in the cabinet dealt with it. In his case, the bullying has become a dismissal of other people, and I think that's what rubs a lot of folks the wrong way. But I was going to say on the transparency piece just real quickly, I mean, it was very shocking when the president decided not to publish the visitor logs. That was something that for people who study OpenGov and the transparency movement that has occurred, it was another way of limiting the contact and concealing from the American public what is actually going on. And so here you have a president that has, you know, thanks to our great team at Governance Studies, a lot of conflicts of interest. You know, there's a lot of people that are in the White House, a president who spends the least amount of time in this public place that actually is found on the golf course, wink, wink, conducting a lot of business, and then turns around and says, I'm not going to publish the visitor logs. And that should make many people concerned that that level of transparency in government is just not there. It's a new normal that has informal norms that in turn have repercussions. You know, I'm pointing to my colleagues down the line when we begin to investigate further what that looks like. The fact that the president didn't want to release his tax returns speaks to the type of transparency we were walking into. And so I think that's a, you know, your question is really well said, because for people, researchers that want to look at government or study government or understand what's actually happening in institutions, it's very hard to do that when you cannot get information or simple things are concealed.
Although Barack Obama was the first president to sort of publish the logs as a matter of course. I mean,
right.
Bill Clinton published them only after he got in trouble on campaign finance issues in 96. Yeah. So no president really likes transparency.
No.
But let me just talk a little bit to your question. I think it goes back to his lack of depth. He has this idea that negotiation is somehow an innate skill, right, that people have. Now, I would not presume to negotiate a real estate deal. I don't know enough about real estate. I would never presume to negotiate that. I think when you see him bullying, it's because he's using that in place of the fact that he has no depth and therefore no ability to negotiate. So he has replaced actual negotiation with bullying. We saw this with the healthcare deal. He didn't know what he was talking about, all right? He really didn't know what he was doing substantively. And my guess is that he's going to think he knows something about tax policy because he's paid taxes and he knows real estate taxes. Or he hasn't paid taxes, right? But he knows something about taxes in real estate. And my guess is he's going to get really surprised, as he was with healthcare, at how complicated this is. And so the point is that people who are great negotiators are often great negotiators because they really understand the substance of what they're doing, and therefore they can figure out options and they can figure out what the other side needs. It goes back to the fact that he doesn't know anything about what he's supposed to do as president. And that means that he relies on sort of his campaign bullying as opposed to actual negotiation.
But I can't believe I'm emerging as the Trump defender. How the heck did that happen? Okay, going back to the learning curve issue. Everything depends on what happens when instincts that have served you well, not only in right. your personal life, but in your campaign, cease to serve you as well as president. And so on the Affordable Care Act repeal and replace, both he and Steve Bannon tried to bully the Freedom Caucus into voting for something that they didn't want to vote for.
And electorally bullied the Freedom Caucus.
Right, and it failed. Yeah. It failed. On the other hand, and we'll see what sorts of inferences he draws from that in phase two, but we've already seen an example of a shift of tactics away from bullying towards dialogue in the case of the People's Republic of China. Because remember the way the president started, even before I think he had taken the oath of office, with an effort to use a démarche to Taiwan as a club over President Xi. And when the Chinese indicated in the clearest possible terms that it didn't work that way, that this was once again a non-negotiable item and could not be used as part of a negotiation, at that point he backed off bigly, as he might say, and is now, and has reaffirmed the traditional, one China policy. And the discussion with President Xi is proceeding on a very different basis now, and apparently, possibly, we'll see with North Korea whether it turns out to be a more productive basis or not. But that shift from presidential, fiat and diktat to an actual conversation with the leader of another important foreign government, I think is not wholly discouraging.
But he also feels a real personal chemistry with him as well. For instance, that he does not seem to feel, for instance, with Angela Merkel or
trademarks in Germany.
Right. That woman. Yeah. But that goes to something that I think touches on the entire issue of management.
Right.
That this panel. that this panel has been convened to discuss. And I've often said, reflecting on my checkered political career, that the best preparation for the presidency is to be governor of a large state. And in many ways, the worst preparation is to be governor of a small state. And why is that? Because if you're governor of a small state, you know, everything in your state is a personalized transaction. You can see the whole thing before you. You don't have this huge bureaucracy to deal with in Georgia or Arkansas, for example. And if you have an excessively personalized understanding of the office of the presidency, if you think it's all one-on-one, you will not take seriously the sorts of things that Elaine and Nicole and John have been talking about staffing the bureaucracy, managing it appropriately, et cetera. That's really not in your skill set. It's not even on your radar screen because you think it's a series of personal transactions. And so the idea that foreign policy should be governed by chemistry rather than enduring national interests is going to be quite self-defeating.
Well, and if I can say on that, what's interesting, you just made me remember, you know, when President Obama came into office, people were very critical about his lack of experience, right? I mean, the whole beginning of his candidacy, appointment was, he lacked the experience because he did not spend enough time, you know, in office. And what's interesting here is, you know, if you compare the two administrations, you know, what happened? What was done differently? And I think, again, a lot of what we're talking about, the personality, the integrity, the longer-term vision, I think is what drew people to Obama to look past some of those faults after a while, to embrace him as somebody who was at least trying to make a difference. It's just, you know, essentially how I think he ended his career. He had a lot of hiccups, a lot of challenges, a lot of barriers, but he managed to solicit advice. I mean, again, I think it's very problematic when we do a transition of government, and from what the news has reported, that President Obama and Trump have only talked once, and that was when he gave him the key to the White House, right, pretty much. And those types of transitions become really important to the collective memory of this country. So I think, you know, I think you're right, Bill, in terms of that, but when you were talking, I just thought about, you know, we were highly critical of Barack Obama, highly critical of him. But yet there was something about this lack of transactional capacity that maybe you're talking about that allowed people to embrace him differently and to surround himself with people that knew how to get the job done. I mean, you know, some of us were critical of that, you know, particularly president.
I mean, but President Obama left office with high approval. He mm-hmm. left office with some big achievements, both, you know, internationally and domestically. But he also left office with his party basically shattered.
Yes. He did.
He was not able to sort of build the kind of enduring governing coalition that, I mean, is that important?
Oh, it's extraordinarily important. I mean, when you lose 1,000 state legislative seats and 12 governorships and majority control of both chambers of Congress, yeah, the Democratic Party's in a pretty tough spot. What the president should do is look at President Obama's electoral legacy down ticket and learn from that. And what he's doing is a steroid-ridden version of what Obama did in terms of destroying the down-ticket Republican Party. I think the special election in Kansas, the special election, the first round in Georgia, really showed how much a Republican Party can fall. And even though the Democrat came up short in Kansas, he shouldn't have come anywhere near that, and you have a Democrat in a pretty decent position in Georgia 6th. That is a problem that Trump needs to address. I mean, there's a lot of jobs that the president has to do. One of them is leader of the party.
Right.
Barack Obama failed miserably at that over 8 years. Donald Trump is positioning himself to fail miserably at that as well. And again, when your White House chief of staff is the former head of the Republican National Committee, this should be easy to be at the top of your agenda, and it's nowhere near the president's agenda.
I think we have time for one more question. So, sir, you've been so patient.
Larry Checco, Checco Communications. This is very interesting. I'd like to throw a little bit of a monkey wrench into this. We talked a lot about experience, and I think that experience has failed the ordinary person in this country. I mean, we've had 16 years of Democrats, and if we go back as far as Ronald Reagan, we have 20 years of Republicans, and these people have not gotten better. I don't think we are looking at politics right now. I think we're looking at simple physics. You squeeze a balloon too hard, too long at one end, and it pops at the other. And that's what we're seeing in this country. That's the reason Donald Trump got here. People would have voted for Donald Duck versus an establishment politician because the establishment has failed them. So I guess my question, and we're seeing this in Europe too now, right now. I guess my question is, what's it going to take for Washington to rehabilitate itself and really focus on the real objective? And that's the people of this country, not fundraising for their own parties, not doing all the cocktail stuff. It's the people who need the attention. And this city, I dare say, will fail until they refocus themselves, both parties. Thank you.
Good point. Make Washington great again?
So what I'll say is your point is well taken, that the both parties need to do quite a bit to rehabilitate themselves, to connect better with not just middle America, not just blue-collar America, but all corners of this country. I think part of that is a refocus of the parties on what they can do better to provide for the citizenry. I think part of it, too, is selling the realities of public policy. There are a lot of Americans who have been failed by the establishment, and there are a lot of Americans who have been made damn better off by the establishment, and they refuse to, not a small slice, they refuse to accept it. The number of people in Kentucky who are going to lose their health care if the Affordable Care Act is repealed is significant. And I bet you a lot of those people voted for Donald Trump. They are much better off in terms of their health care now than they were 7 years ago, and a lot of them fail to admit it. That's not a defense of the establishment. It's a defense of policy realities that I think both the establishment in Washington and the average American needs to reset themselves very seriously, because neither of them have it completely right. It's not all the establishment's fault, and it's not all roses across America. And I think part of that has to be an open and honest conversation, starting in the White House and trickling through every single office of a member of Congress and a senator, to begin to have a dialogue with their constituents, to hear from them what is going wrong and what is actually going right, and for those elected officials also to have that honest conversation about what is good. When you have both parties politicizing every issue at every opportunity to defeat the other guy, that's how this skewed, misguided perception of what public policy in America does. That's how it happens. And so, again, the establishment has failed a lot of Americans, and the conversation about what policy is doing has also failed Americans, deluding them into thinking that all government is bad. All government isn't bad. Without it, we're just as failed as people believe we are with it.
Right. I mean, I was going to say, I mean, when I reflect as a sociologist on how we got here, right, I used to tell people the Bernie Sanders conversation at the dinner table was the same conversation as the Trump conversation at the dinner table. It's just that one won out, right? Because you had a party that focused more on the personality, and then you had a person who focused on the issues, right? And the, you know, we can go into a lot of great length, and I know my colleague here has talked about it, in terms of the campaign and a new book has come out, all that other stuff. The bottom line, I think, you know, and I'm looking at Daryl, mega change has come, right? We're seeing this spiral effect that's not only here, but internationally. And I agree with John. I think part of it is this distrust of party politics. The other part of it is this distrust of the establishment, quote unquote, Washington. But I also think it's a distrust of who we are as a people, right? What is it that we desire? The transfer of wealth to our kids, the ability to have health care, the degradation of our own net assets, of things that we never thought that we would actually not be able to transfer over. All of that has factored in. And, you know, when I think about it, because we're all, and even in this panel, we keep talking about him as a person, the return to government will require us to go back to this institutional framework of what we desire government to be for people, you know, to have that conversation the way it's supposed to be had. We should not be spending the oxygen in the room continuing to talk about this person, although it's important, and his personality, but figuring out how to drive towards good policymaking. Because when I look at the Democratic Party today, you know, there's a conference going on right now, I think, or yesterday, where Bernie Sanders is talking to the Power to the People conference, you know, and Elizabeth Warren is out there doing her stuff, you know, and showing up on Twitter in terms of being, and the Democrats, we don't, you know, they don't know what they want to do at this point, because it's just how, they can't figure out how this happened. But as, you know, I tell people, you have to move beyond that and think about what Trump did well was that he went to the heart of what people were thinking at that moment. There was something about losing a job, losing a pension, not having employment that he spoke to. And until we as a country begin to speak to those policies that matter, I think we'll actually go back into a state where, you know, we actually might become more moderate, I tell people, versus one or the other.
I do recall a presidential candidate who referred to that as putting people first.
Yeah. That's right. Yes, that's right.
But the, I mean, I think we have to widen the frame here.
Yeah.
The United States may be exceptional in some respects, but in its contemporary politics, it's anything but
right.
exceptional. The same problems are roiling every Western democracy, and for the same reason, and that is that we are going through an economic transition, certainly comparable in speed, intensity, and scope to the transition from the agricultural economy of the 19th century to the industrial economy of the 20th century. As you may recall, that spawned the real populist movement as opposed to a full populist movement. And in many respects, we and the Brits and the French and the Hungarians and the Poles, just about everyone except the Germans, interestingly, you know, are experiencing their version of this. There's a reason for this. And that is that no one has figured out how, no one anywhere has figured out how to preserve what it was that a certain slice of the population most cherished about the industrial economy. No one. I suspect, in the end, there is no answer to that question. In the same way that if someone had said, how can we preserve a thriving agricultural sector in the 20th century with as many farmers as a share of the population as we had in 1890, the answer is it can't be done.
Right.
Okay, so this is not a failure of governance to do what is clearly obvious and good because of the influence of special interests. This is a much deeper challenge than that. And we may be in a very tumultuous political situation for the better part of a generation until we manage somehow to come out the other side.
And I'll just end this
yes.
with one short question for the audience, which is Trumpism the beginning of something or is it the end of something? You see? And that's what we don't know. I mean, you and I could argue this both ways, following on Bill's comments, that this could be the end of something. There's a generational passage, a generation that remembers the old economy and is mad about it. And there's a different generation out there about to come into power, which is more globalized, more into the newer economy. What is this? Right, and I think we can ask that for the European countries as well going through this. Is this the beginning of something or the end of something? I frankly will say I don't know the answer to that. But
I think it's the beginning of the end.
Oh, Bill, that's a total cop out.
Thank you all very much.
I really do.